Welcome to episode 48 of GBW Podcast. My name is Josh, and with me as always is Chris.
Hello.
Hello.
Why do you seem like you're going to bust out laughing?
Because I just thought I sounded way too serious. Okay. But it is serious. We haven't seen each other for like a month.
I know, because I had vacation.
Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, and that means that Josh has a lot to talk about because...
Because I wasn't on vacation. When I was on working 12-hour days.
When I was on vacation, I watched a whole two movies. One of them was Reality Bites.
Yes.
And the other one we'll talk about.
But you watched something else, too, that we're also going to talk about very soon.
Yes.
But the this episode, we're going to be honoring another director that we love. This time, we're going to be talking about Mr. Sam Raimi,
yes.
Who's given us a lot of entertainment over the years. So yep. We'll be going through his career. But as Chris just mentioned, first of all, as usual, we're going to be talking about what we've watched. Or what I've watched.
Buckle yourselves in, because I saw Josh told me how many titles he had to bring up. So this might be another one of those, hey, we're almost 2 hours in. Where the fuck's the topic?
Well, you know what? We've gotten feedback. People do like this part of the show.
Oh, okay, good.
So, hey.
Good.
People have said that they could just deal with us talking about what we watched. So
good.
Fuck it.
Because I enjoy it. So hope I'm glad,
I like it. It's,
I'm glad
it's one of my
like
favorite.
It.
Yeah. So
why don't you start?
So whatever.
Jesus Christ. You don't have to get bitter about it.
Well, we're 48 episodes in. That's 48.
Yeah.
That's a lot of episodes. And we've been doing the same fucking thing since the beginning. So I think people are okay with it.
Okay. Well, let's start.
All right. Okay. So I just want to talk a little bit about... I find this whole thing quite interesting. Okay.
Okay.
Because there's all this talk about nostalgia lately. And I've been really kind of wondering, just, you know, with, I didn't really like the new Star Wars that much. I'm just not that into a lot of blockbusters. They're not doing the same for me as they used to.
But really, Josh, is it nostalgia or is it cash in?
Okay. Well, here's the thing. Like, I just kind of, you know, I've always been kind of like, I'm always like, why don't I feel like I did when I was young?
Because you're cynical and old like me.
Okay, good. That's kind of where I'm going with this whole thing.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna talk about a few movies that like I went to the theater and saw. I'm gonna tell you right now, one of them was Ghostbusters, the other one was Suicide Squad.
Yep.
And you know, again, and both of those ones I went with a kid, mm-hmm. and he loved both. And I was like, fuck, you know, what is it? What's going on with all this stuff? Like, is it me? Am I just old now? Is that why I'm not digging this stuff? Or are movies just shitty now? And that's why I'm not liking them. And, you know, I
could be a bit of both.
A lot of me recently has been thinking, you know, it's the age, right? Like, I just don't have that same kind of wide-eyed wonder and enjoyment of things that I did when I was young.
But,
and even though these are nostalgic and are supposed to be kind of cashing in on me reclaiming that, it's still not really working for me. Like, Star Wars didn't work for me. There's just a lot of, like, the only one that's really worked for me recently is Mad Max.
Yeah.
And, but I think that was not really, I don't think they were really going for nostalgia on that one.
I feel like a lot of this now, the difference between our youth and having that wide-eyed wonder.
Yeah.
And what's coming out now has to do with the fact that, a lot of it just seems to be an assault nowadays. Just an assault of effects nonstop. Just like more of an ADHD kind of pace. Because
true.
You know, I mean, you had big special effects movies when we were kids in the 80s, right? But it was like, it wasn't like just nonstop. And I feel like most blockbuster movies now are just nonstop.
That is true. I mean, I think there's a combination of things. But, my main point here is I was just really starting to feel like I am...
A curmudgeon.
Kind of, yeah. I just felt like, you know, shit, you know, I'm getting older and I'm just not liking this stuff anymore. And then along comes Stranger Things.
Yes.
Which completely blows that hypothesis out of the water because this thing...
This is the most nostalgic out of everything you're going to talk about.
It is nostalgic... But I didn't feel like it was nostalgic.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, when we're talking about nostalgia, in the last 2 weeks, I've seen the best thing I probably have seen in the 2000s. I'll be honest. I loved Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing I've seen in the 2000s, which is Ghostbusters.
Right.
I even think it was worse than Crystal Skull, which is saying a lot.
I haven't seen Crystal Skull, but yeah.
Don't. But
I'm going to eventually.
I just think the whole thing is quite interesting. And I don't know what the Duffer Brothers did, like how they did this so perfectly. But I thought this was... So we're going to talk. Let's talk about this right now.
I think it's got a lot to do with hitting the mark tonally. You know, they set the show in 1983 and it felt authentic, which is the main thing. You know, you had the kids playing Dungeons and Dragons, right?
Yeah. So this is a show that's on Netflix. If people don't know, yeah. It's just came out of nowhere. These directors kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah, they do have a movie they made last year called Hidden that I'm really intrigued by. It stars Alexander Skarsgård.
Yep.
And it's about a family who hides out in like a bomb shelter and like someone tries to get in. So it's kind of like, kind of gives me that 10 Cloverfield Lane vibe, even though I haven't seen that movie either.
But yeah, I am curious about it.
But I'm really curious about that one.
And they did some work on Wayward Pines, but they really haven't done much, right?
Yeah, like, and I knew about Stranger Things before it premiered, because I remember hearing about it and hearing what kind of show it was. And then I saw that artwork that kind of looks like a Drew Struzan work, but isn't him.
Who's Drew Struzan?
He's the guy who did all those awesome 80s movie posters, you know, Indiana Jones.
Oh, okay.
You know, he's the guy who's famous for doing these hand-drawn.
Right.
Like, he did the Star Wars stuff, too. Oh, okay, yeah, right? Yeah. He's just got that style. He's got a couple really cool coffee table books of his art that are really expensive but really cool.
Right on.
And so this right there, when I was like, okay, this artist is emulating Drew Struzan,
okay,
I'm in.
Yeah,
you know, and it worked. I watched it.
So this thing, I gotta say, man, like, I watched like I don't binge watch anymore.
No, I don't either.
A friend of mine told me he doesn't binge watch because he feels like you lose something when you binge watch.
Well, you do, because like you don't have that anticipation. Like when we were kids and we watched, you know, series television.
Yeah.
You had to wait a week.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to wait a week with Netflix, but, you know, if you're watching it all in one, like, shot.
Yeah.
It's just, it loses that factor because you don't have a chance to absorb what you've seen. Because you're just like, you're watching, you're like, on the next one, on to the next one, on to the next one. You can't absorb everything. It's just too much all at once.
Yeah.
Because, like, when I watch...
Exactly.
When I watch Stranger Things, the most I watched in a row was two.
Yeah.
But it took me a week and a bit to watch all eight episodes.
Yeah, it took me about 2 weeks because I was watching one a night.
Because you kind of had it set up so that it was like your treat.
Exactly.
Right? Like you're like, oh, I get to go home and I get to watch an episode tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like I've worked 12 hours. I'm going to go watch Stranger Things.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
Whereas me, I was like, okay, everyone fucking loves this show. Josh says to me, dude, you better watch this.
Yeah.
This is a show that premiered the day before I went away on vacation.
Yeah.
So I was away from like pretty much away from the internet and away from Netflix for like three solid weeks.
Yeah.
So I get back and the show's blown up.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I better watch it.
Yeah.
And you know, everyone should watch it.
It's really good. And
let's just do a basic premise.
Yeah. Very basic.
So the basic premise of this show is it's, like I said, set in 1983 and it's about these three friends who, you know, they're what would you say, they're about 12,
yeah.
And you know, they play Dungeons and Dragons, they kind of like, you know, do things, typical things that I did in the 80s. And basically
they're kind of nerdy, like they're not super popular. Yeah. they get
bullied
like
a little bit.
They're like us.
And it's basically about them. What's a way to explain it? What's the best way to explain it?
Well,
it's four friends.
One of the friends goes missing in the first episode right away.
Yeah, and then it's just
about the search for the friend.
Yeah, it's about the search for the friend, but there's other extenuating circumstances that come into play that are kind of fantastical.
Yes.
And we'll leave it at that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But this show, like, seriously, like, and I'm not kidding here, I think I loved every minute of this show. Like, there was never any time in this show where I was bored or where I felt like there was padding. I felt like everything was important. I thought every character was great. I thought it was cast perfectly. The music is fucking stellar. The plot is like, the pacing and everything is just perfect. Like, there's nothing bad I can say about this. Nothing. And that's really rare coming from me.
I'm pretty sure that once I heard the synth of that opening theme, I was like, okay, I'm all in on this. You know, like, it's like I said, it does hit that aesthetic of the 80s because it's set in the 80s. It's very authentic feeling to me.
I wasn't feeling like the 80s. I wasn't feeling like the 80s was being rammed down my throat. Thing,
like,
you know,
it was authentic.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like, oh, look at us, we're being witty, we're doing the 80s.
It felt like I was watching an 80s movie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
And, but the thing is, like, the Duffer Brothers who created the show, I mean, this show is just packed to the hilt with homages to, you know, the 80s. And
oh,
you
yeah.
know, Steven Spielberg particularly. Lots of Stephen King stuff in this. Yeah. Like, the main thing that I would compare this to would be, like, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Like, I got a lot of similar vibes that I got when I watched E.T.
Yeah, they're calling it, like, they use in their description.
E.T. Close Encounters.
They were calling it
Stand
Amblin,
by Me.
Like, heavy, yeah. or Dark Amblin or
totally,
something.
Totally.
That's what they were calling it, which it was.
And, you know, that's great. I mean, it's great to have your influences shown.
Yeah.
But the thing is, a lot of times when people show their influences, they let that kind of sway their creativity.
Yes.
And I don't feel like the Duffers did that.
No, I don't
feel
like
they took what their influences were and spun it in an angle that would fit perfectly in that universe.
Yeah.
But was its own entity at the same time. And, you know, it can go toe to toe with the stuff Amblin was making, but at the same time, it was just as good as the stuff Amblin was making without being like a look at us, wink, wink, look at all these references. We're so fun.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's what makes it a really, truly special thing.
Oh, it absolutely was. I still can't believe how good this thing is. And I can't believe, like normally I don't like shows with kids.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of that.
No, you're not.
But these kids, I loved all of them.
Yeah.
I was sold pretty much right away on them. Yep. And I really enjoyed all three of them. The lead guy, Finn Wolfhard, I really, really, really liked him.
Wolfhard.
I just love the way he, even the way he like moved, I thought it was really unique and cool.
Well, the thing is, they were all had their own distinct personalities.
Yeah.
But, and you could totally buy that these guys would be the kind of guys who would group together in school.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the main character, he was the kind of like, he was kind of a serious guy in a way, but he was like, you know, very sensitive type.
Yeah.
And then the other friend was like the kind of sarcastic, like, you guys are being stupid. You know, what do you think you're doing? And then there was just the goofball one.
Yeah.
You know, and they all played off each other perfectly fine. Like they all worked well together. They had great chemistry. And, you know, all these kids hadn't really been in anything up to this point.
Yeah.
So to be able to cast it that way and get that kind of interplay is actually pretty good.
Yeah, like, I totally agree. It's interesting that Finn kid is going to be in It.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that. Mm-hmm. And I actually really liked David Harbour.
Oh, he's
as the
so
sheriff.
Good
he was my favorite character in the entire show. I just thought he was like, there was just something about his character that just you were like, okay, this is the guy who's gonna solve everything for me. Like, this guy's the hero of this piece, no doubt. And
he felt like your hero, you know, like he was cool. He was a cool guy.
Yeah.
And again, like, it's just in a world where cool is Matt Damon, it's so nice to see like an actual
normal dude,
normal, cool guy that I kind of looked up to when I was young.
Right.
Like, these were the kind of characters that I really kind of gravitated to when I was a kid. So seeing that again, instead of just some, you know, hip little action star, like, in, you know, this was like a regular flawed man.
Well, exactly.
And it was so nice to see that as well.
You know, and it's nice to see Winona Ryder again, because I haven't seen much of her lately. And
yeah,
she was always like a super cute girl in the 90s and 80s. And it's good to see her taking on a more kind of adulty role and like going with it and bringing a character too that's kind of like you know, people think she's crazy in the show,
yeah,
but really she's one of the more sensible people in the entire thing.
But she still kind of played like came off as crazy. And
yeah, like,
and I thought that was really brave
but
of her.
It was justified in
true.
A way.
But she could have, you know, she could have been all worried about her image. And, you know, yeah. I mean, this is not a role you would pick if you're worried about your image, right?
Right.
Mean, and I thought she was fantastic as well. I also really liked the two main adolescent kids, Nancy and the other guy, Jonathan.
Yeah.
The brother and the sister.
Yep.
Not, they weren't a brother and sister together, but
well, the brother of the missing
Mike's sister,
the
and,
brother of the yeah. of the missing kid, and then the sister of one of the main friends.
Yeah, they were both great. And then there was that side character, her boyfriend,
who I was a fucking douche.
He was, but I just thought again, like
good really acting,
perfectly cast, and everyone and, had their
and
own
the silver fox, Matthew Modine.
Oh yeah, Matthew Modine. Yeah,
there's a guy I hadn't seen in forever,
and again, great. Like, so yeah, yeah like we're saying, like everything.
Yeah,
about
like
this,
the casting of that show was pretty much spot on.
Yeah,
there was not one character or one actor in that who didn't portray the role the way it should have been.
Yeah,
I said to my girlfriend when we were watching it. I said, you know, this is kind of like. At its heart, Stranger Things is really a coming of age movie.
Yeah.
That just so happens to have, you know, monsters and telekinesis.
Exactly.
Among other things.
And there's another actress as well that's just a total scene stealer.
Yeah.
The girl who played Eleven and Millie Bobby Brown. This is, again, I couldn't believe I was watching a kid half the time.
Yeah. And like we, like I said earlier, I am glad I didn't binge watch it.
No.
Because I got to absorb things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like I said, that's why I don't binge watch. Because if you're watching, you know, these 8 episodes in the span of 24 hours.
Yeah.
You're probably not going to get as much out of it as if you space it out and, like, kind of savor it.
Well, I was actually really tempted to binge watch it. Like, I'd finish an episode and I'd be like, oh, fuck, I want to know what happened.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I mean, thank you. I'm just shout out to John. Thank you so much for that discussion because I'm really glad I didn't, you know, there would be a bit of a cliffhanger and I would hold myself back. And
well, it's like,
it was a real treat the next day.
It's like I said, you know, I watched 2 in a row.
Yeah.
Maximum.
Yeah.
And also the thing is, it's like, speaking of cliffhangers, okay, we're going to go a little bit off track on this. It's like I was telling you earlier.
Let's go off track? What?
It's like I was telling you a little bit earlier, you know? Walking Dead. Everyone got upset that there was a cliffhanger at the end of last season. I haven't watched the show. You said the cliffhanger kind of sucked. But people are getting upset that there was a cliffhanger to the point that the showrunners have now said, we're not going to do that this season because everyone was so mad at us. In the 80s, television was about cliffhangers.
See, I don't remember.
I remember it all the time.
Do you? Like, Nate, yeah. Give me an example.
JR being shot on Dallas?
See, I didn't watch Dallas.
No, but like every show had a cliffhanger pretty much. And, you know, that makes it also makes it like build your excitement for something, right? Because like you said, you could have binge watched it. But when you left it on a cliffhanger, you were like, oh, shit, I want to know what happens next. But I'm going to wait till tomorrow. And then when it happens, I'm going to be like, holy fuck, this
okay.
is great.
I've got an opinion about this.
Yeah.
I think the difference is back in the 80s or whatever, when we were watching yeah. shows and there was a cliffhanger, you weren't going to fucking know what happened. But I guarantee you that we will know what happened on Walking Dead before it airs. Because there'll be someone out there that's taking set pictures and
yeah.
it'll be slowly whittled down.
Well, that's the
you know, through IMDb, people are already like hypothesizing on Walking Dead. Oh, so-and-so's, you know, working on this series now, so it must be him. Or
but
this other person is
that's the internet for
was
you.
Spotted in, you know, they're filming the next season and this person was spotted in California. It must be them, right? So like they're already kind of. And I just feel like all of that bullshit, if you're, and it's pretty hard to avoid it sometimes, especially with a show like Walking Dead, we're going to know before it goes to air. I guarantee you.
Yeah.
We're going to have a pretty good idea.
But that's what the internet does
as to what happened. And that's why I think that was kind of shitty because it could have been a big shocker then. But now if we already know when we go into the next season who it was, it's not going to really be a shocker.
The thing I don't understand is that I felt that Stranger Things ended. I'm not spoiling anything by saying this. I felt like it ended.
Careful.
I felt like it ended open in a lot of ways.
It did.
Like, it didn't.
There were unanswered questions.
It didn't feel the need to explain everything. Yeah. And I feel like people were getting upset at Walking Dead because it didn't explain things. Like, it left cliffhangers. And I just feel like modern audiences these days, and I see this with movies too. I see this with movies like The Witch. I've seen this with movies like Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Mm. People want shit to be explained to them because they don't want to use their fucking imaginations.
True.
And that is why I'm surprised that this show is getting such the praise it is, because I'm like, where the, like, if you go on IMDb message boards, like, if you go on IMDb for Stranger Things, 9.1 user rating, go on the message boards, all it is people trashing the show.
I did notice that, and I was like, who the fuck are these people?
That's weird. But it's because everybody wants everything spelt out for them these days. Because
is that just why they were trying? I stopped reading.
Some of it was. Yeah. But it's like, I just don't understand that. Like, wouldn't you want to get the opportunity to draw your own conclusions? Doesn't that make things a lot more interesting if you're discussing with somebody?
Well, could you? Yeah, if you're a fan of the show, you can talk about what those things meant.
Well, exactly, right? Like, yeah. That's why I'm like, when you were saying, okay, I'm cool with the season two, it'll be better than the season one. And I'm just like, well, I'm okay. I would watch a season two, but I'm just wondering how they're going to spin it.
It'll be better. And season two is almost always better than season one.
But I'm just wondering how they're going to spin it, right? And I'm hoping that some of these unanswered questions that I've been drawing my own conclusions about don't get answered in a way.
Yeah.
Because then it's kind of ruining what I've come up with in my imagination. You know what I mean?
Well, I feel like these guys are kind of like master storytellers. I'm not worried about it at all.
Okay, well.
I think it's going to be great.
What we've drawn the conclusion here is that if you have Netflix, you should watch Stranger Things.
Yes.
ASAP.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Don't wait. This is one to really, really enjoy, and it really brought my sort of feelings back. Of, and I don't even know if back. It just sort of made me really appreciate that great shit can still be made, you know. And I've been really kind of doubting that, especially on a bigger level, like a Netflix type level. I mean, yeah, you know, I know there's been some pretty good TV shows lately and stuff like that, but this is great. This is a different level than stuff I've been watching. Like, Walking Dead's fine. Like, I enjoy it and all. I know you don't, but I do. But this is a different thing.
Right.
And something that I've missed, and I'm really glad to have something like this. And I really hope maybe people, I'm always harping about story and plot, and I'm always saying that's what's wrong with a lot of Hollywood these days and why there's so many problems and why I don't enjoy things. And this one focused on that for a fucking change, which
right.
really made a difference.
So why don't we talk about Hollywood now? Why don't we go on to the other two movies and you can explain.
I don't know if I've had enough to drink to talk about Ghostbusters.
You can explain to me how this ties in with Stranger Things.
All right.
While you hammer down some alcohol to try and lube yourself up for a rant.
First, we'll talk about Suicide Squad.
Okay. Which I have no interest in.
Neither did I. But sometimes you got to take one for the team.
No, we're not going to talk about Suicide Squad because a bunch of nerds who are angry are going to try and get the podcast shut down.
So what's the story there?
The story was that they started a petition online to get Rotten Tomatoes shut down because the critic score was bad. It is like Metacritic. It's compiling and making an average score of reviews. Rotten Tomatoes didn't make that decision. That was the critics.
Yes.
So because these people were like, oh, I'm so fucking excited about Suicide Squad. It's going to be the best. And then the reviews came out and they were poor.
Yeah.
They're like, no, they're wrong. Let's get this site shut down. They managed to get over 10,000 signatures on this shit.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Nerd rage is something that I've become well aware of since I hopped on the internet in the late 90s.
Oh, well, there's going to be a bit more nerd rage coming up.
It's getting worse, man. It's getting worse. Oh.
Okay, so in the first of our nerd rage duo, yeah, Suicide Squad. Okay, so just first of all.
Your nerd rage is different, though.
As we know, I'm not a big comic guy.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I'm a bigger comic guy than you.
I don't know anything about Suicide Squad. I just know all I knew about this is there's this hot chick named Harley Quinn,
which is Joker's girlfriend.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah. And I know that this is there are a bunch of villains that are hired, like kind of like the Dirty Dozen, to like go and do some task. Yeah. Okay. So that's all I knew about this. I didn't know any of their backstories. I didn't know anything about any of them.
Well, and apparently you don't really know a lot about the backstories afterwards anyway, because they cut a few of them out of the movie.
So sorry if I'm losing listeners here because I'm not a comic guy, but I'm not. And I'm kind of happy I'm not sometimes, especially when I do go to these movies like this one and Batman versus Superman and all the Marvel stuff. Like, I just don't really know anything, so I don't really care. Like, that, I'm kind of going with the universe that's being created for me. So the other thing I know about this is that it is a bunch of bad guys, like murderers and shit. And it's a PG-13 rated movie. So I'm kind of like, that's weird. Cause this, if all the ones, like, you know, with Deadpool coming out and everything like that, I would have felt like this one should have been an R rating. Maybe, like, it just seemed to make more sense to me. If you're going with the notion of a bunch of like crazy killers and stuff getting together, I would think they're going to be pretty, it should be pretty fucking dark.
And you would hope so.
You would think. On top of that, when you've got a director like David Ayer, who is known for doing like war movies, he did Harsh Times, Fury. Yeah.
This is also another one.
End of Watch. So, like, yeah, dark movies, right?
The thing is, this is also a guy who, when Suicide Squad didn't get good, very good notice, he went on Twitter and cried about it too.
Oh, did he? He was one of those guys?
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Like him and the Fantastic Four guy should get together and make a movie called Fuck Marvel, Fuck DC.
Well, he seems like he's a pretty, he's got a decent track record, right?
Yeah. The thing is, it's like.
But a dark track record.
Sure. It's great to take a chance on someone making a superhero movie, like, you know, like James Gunn doing Guardians of the Galaxy, right?
Yeah.
It's good to take a chance like that. But at the same time, it's like you said, maybe they hired him originally because Suicide Squad, you know, you think it's a bunch of killers being hired to kill people. And you're like, that's going to be a dark movie, so let's hire this guy who can do that. And then you make your movie PG-13.
Well, I read an article about why all these directors are getting these big movies. And the reason is because the, like, established directors, like, people that are good directors, like that are established good directors of big movies, don't want to do these movies because they don't want to have to contend with the studio interference and the shooting schedule, because they're like pushing these things through so fast that a lot of the, you know, directors that are used to making movies of this caliber know they can't really get it done properly in the time period, so they're giving it to these young guys who are just trying to like boost their career up, like take the next big thing. And then they're finding themselves in these situations where they're overwhelmed. Right. And I don't know what the deal was behind the scenes with David Ayer on this one, but it watching this movie, it absolutely feels like studio meddling big time. Now, I think a lot of this was, from what I understand. Now, I don't know how much I can believe on the internet, but the understanding I have is that after Batman versus Superman came out, that there was talk that DC was being too dark, so they wanted to lighten it up a bit. So they went in and made some changes to make it not quite as serious. So, you know, you got Harley Quinn cracking jokes all the time.
Quinn's always been like that, though.
And there's a guy with like a crocodile guy, and he's always like, he's kind of like the comic relief, like gruff guy. It gave a really interesting dynamic because, again, these people are all supposed to be crazy and psychotic killers, yet they're like doing one-liners and they're having like moments where, you know, you're like sort of feeling for them, which didn't really feel right to me. It felt like someone was making that happen, that it maybe shouldn't have been happening. Like, there's one scene in particular in the middle of the film where they, you know, sort of all get together in this bar and they're like sort of like pouring their hearts out to each other, and it's kind of like, what? Like,
you're a psychotic murderer.
I'm not supposed to be like liking you that much, right? Like, and I was, again, sitting there with an 11-year-old, you're kind of like, what kind of messaging is this? Right? Like, it's just kind of a weird, it was just kind of a weird tone, and the tone kind of shifted, like kept going back and forth, and like I never really bought that some of these guys were that crazy, but they kept telling me they were crazy. Like, Harley, everyone's like, Harley Quinn, you're so crazy, and I'm like, oh, I guess she's crazy, you know. So
you're so crazy, you wear short shorts and have a mallet, look at you, you crazy thing.
Yeah, so so she was great. I mean, you know, for sure, that Margot Robbie playing her, and I gotta say, I don't like Will Smith very much, but I thought he kind of carried this one quite a bit. He played Deadshot.
Yeah,
does he?
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, he's kind of the star, and I didn't think he was. I thought he was a side character, but he's kind of the star.
I'm glad to hear you say you don't like Will Smith that much, because I thought I was alone.
I don't like Will Smith, but I gotta say, I was kind of happy he was in this.
I'm giving you an across the room high five for not liking Will Smith. Well,
yeah, but I am saying, like, I kind of was happy that he was there.
Okay, that's fine.
Like, he really kind of brought this one. I think without him and her, this would have been a real disaster. Now, the thing with this movie is the first 45 minutes or so was a complete mess. Like, it was like they were trying to like introduce all these characters, then they were trying to like introduce backstory of the characters, and then they were also throwing in like weird like musical cues, I guess, to like hype everyone up. So it would be like cutting from like, you know, a character doing like, you know, something real bad because they're all real bad guys, and then it would cut to like you know, there'd be some like Bohemian Rhapsody would come on and they'd all be like shooting guns in unison. You know, it was just really ill-timed and weird. And like the editing, I was trying to think of like what the editing was like. And I was like, this would be like if the editor like brought the film canisters to like his kid's daycare and they went crazy with scissors. Like, that's what it was like. It really felt
hey,
like
kids, you want to edit a movie?
Oh, yeah! Exactly. It felt like just thrown together. Like nothing was, there was no flow. It was just all over the place. And I was like, holy shit, this is fucking terrible. But once they settled into like their plot and like what they were trying to achieve, I thought the movie actually ended up being okay. I'm not, now don't get me wrong, I'm not giving this a big thumbs up or anything, but it was certainly not nearly as bad as I was expecting it to be. And I didn't hate it.
Not nearly as bad as what?
We'll get there. One thing I didn't like, though, is I did not like Jared Leto as the Joker.
Yeah, he...
And now, again...
Even when they released early images of him as the Joker, I was like, no, that's wrong.
Yeah. Now, I don't know... Like, the Joker I know is Cesar Romero from the Batman TV series. That's kind of what I think of when I think of the Joker. I don't know the comics that well.
Yeah.
I thought Heath Ledger was pretty good, but I'm not, like, a big fanboy about him like everyone else seems to be. Nicholson, it's been so long.
Nicholson was so campy.
Yeah, it's been so long.
But the thing
can't
is,
even comment.
Speaking of Suicide Squad being PG-13 and having the Joker in it and everything, I don't get why they went PG-13 with this when they just released Batman the Killing Joke, which is an animated movie.
Right.
And it's restricted.
Oh, is it restricted?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I didn't know that.
I mean, it's based on the graphic novel, which is one of my favorite graphic novels of all time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's apparently not supposed to be that great, admittedly, but how can you go
the cartoon?
Oh, okay. So how can you go R-rated basically on a home video cartoon release?
Wait, hold on, saying cartoon is like all the like comic people and animators,
animated,
they're all like feeling like chalkboard scraping.
Okay,
right,
well,
now animated. Sorry guys, sorry.
To go animated R-rated,
yeah,
and then have Suicide Squad, which is about murderers,
yeah,
and make it PG-13 doesn't make sense to me either.
Yeah, PG-13 was a mistake on this.
Yeah.
And it, you know, again, like I felt...
And think of the success that Deadpool had being restricted.
Exactly.
I mean, Suicide Squad's not doing bad, but if they would have bumped it up a little bit to an R maybe, they would have drawn in a more adult crowd. I just feel like catering to children which this movie kind of is, like catering to younger kids and having the basic of your main group being a bunch of cold-blooded killers.
It was weird.
It's weird.
It was really weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I'm not a big fan of this
because it's not like they're making
movie.
Him like it's not like they're making him into anti-heroes where their morals take over, right?
Well, you could kind of,
but not enough that you'd be like, okay, I could see why. Okay,
no,
yeah,
no,
see?
No, yeah, like, it was weird. It was a weird dynamic. The whole thing was just a weird dynamic that I think could have been better. And I just feel like it. I think it got pulled in a bunch of different directions and ended up being okay. It was okay. I wasn't like mad I was in the theater, but I was certainly questioning things
all right
fairly regularly.
Okay, got you.
So why don't we talk about the other big blockbuster I saw?
Let's talk about it.
So I saw Ghostbusters and
when I found out you did,
wow,
I said to myself, the only reason that I'm going to accept that Josh went to see Ghostbusters is if he went with the kid.
and I did.
Sure enough, you did. So I was like, that's okay then. Because if you would have went at your own free will, I would not be sitting here right now.
Okay. So when I knew that my destiny for the day... Okay.
Your destiny for the day. You're like, my day was going pretty good till I had to go see fucking Ghostbusters.
Okay, when I knew that was what was happening, I was like, okay, I'm going to go into this with an open mind. Now, I just want to say...
You're not going to go into it with being like, it's girls, fuck this movie!
No. Okay, so I just want to be...
stupid.
I want to be really clear about this. I couldn't have given a rat's ass about
that. That whole thing is stupid.
At the beginning. I didn't care about the... Okay. I did not care that they casted women in this movie.
No, that everyone who cares about that are...
But I did care about the women they cast in this movie.
Okay.
So, to me... Okay, I like Kristen Wiig. I'm going to give her a bit of a pass.
Yeah, she's...
Because she
when she's not doing goofy Hollywood movies, she has made some really good movies off the side. There's a movie she made with Bill Hader called The Skeleton Twins, which is fucking great.
Okay.
So, you know, she gets a pass. Yes.
And yeah, and I liked her in Saturday Night Live. I liked her in Whip It. You know, I do like her. I liked her in Bridesmaids.
Yeah, she was good in Whip It. And Bridesmaids was fun.
Okay. Melissa McCarthy, I do not like.
I don't understand.
Don't know why I don't like her. Just don't like her.
I just don't understand her appeal.
Well, I do understand the appeal, but... Well, I no, I don't. It's not appealing to me.
No.
But people like the kind of, you know, chubby, goofy person.
I just don't get it. Like, I don't get how you can make a career out of doing the same thing over and over again.
It's true. Well, a lot of people do that.
Well,
Jack
I guess.
Nicholson. But I mean,
who was that?
Jack Nicholson. But you know,
I thought you were saying Jim Carrey.
No, I mean, a lot of people do that. But I mean, I'm just not a fan of her style of humor.
No, me.
Okay.
Either.
Leslie Jones, don't know much about her. She was on Saturday Night Live. Don't know much about her. Didn't really like her.
Right.
Kate McKinnon, everyone seems to be going crazy over Kate McKinnon. I couldn't stand her in this movie.
Okay.
Now, probably going to get hate mail over that one, but...
So she was like the Egon, right?
She was the Egon.
Okay.
But I found her to be over the top, unfunny, just goofy faces all the time.
Right.
I felt like she was like just kind of in the wrong movie. Like, you know, they would just be like, you know, something would happen, cut to her goofy face, you know, and like it would just, I just didn't work for me. So I would have had the same problem though, had they cast like Martin Lawrence and who's that Paul Blart guy and like that
Kevin James.
That's kind of what I'm thinking, like the equivalent casting would have been if it was men. Would have been Martin Lawrence. It would have been that guy from...
No, dude, it wouldn't have been Martin Lawrence nowadays. It would have been Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart. Right, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Sorry, whatever. Mm-hmm. But no, yeah, it would have been Kevin Hart. It would have been the guy from Paul Blart, Mall Cop, and a couple others. You know, there would have been someone probably pretty good, and then
I don't know, like, what's that guy's name? Is that guy who's in fucking Jason Sudeikis or someone like that?
Yeah, the guy from Vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it would have been that kind of cast, right? So I would have had the same exact problem with this remake.
Well, because it's unnecessary.
It's just you're just trying to cash in on an old thing.
Yeah.
You're trying to cash in on the, you know, quote unquote stardom of these up and coming actors, and it just felt really poorly conceived from the get go to me. Paul Feig, who is the director, is known for doing like Bridesmaids and I think The Heat, or
yeah,
known for doing like comedies. I didn't feel like he was really a good choice for making a big sci-fi movie, but you know, reference back 5 minutes to when I was talking about why they're giving these guys these
big
movies.
But on the same retrospect on that, what you're saying is Ivan Reitman, who did the original Ghostbusters, wasn't really a sci-fi kind of... He was more of a comedy dude, too.
True, but I just felt... It just felt different then. Like,
right.
I also felt like back then, it was just a different style of filmmaking. Yeah. That one more relied on the comedy. This one more relies on the effects.
Oh, okay.
Right? And that's, I think, right. The difference. Okay. Back to when we were talking
about
it.
Well, it relies on the comedy when Kate McKinnon's pulling a goofy face.
No, okay. I got it. People love her.
They'll show her Slimer, and then they cut to her. She's like... She's got that look, I shit my pants.
Yeah, that's totally what she does. But people love her. I don't understand. I don't hate her or anything, but I really don't get where yeah. I'm like, oh, no, Kate McKinnon steals the
like
show.
I've been like hearing that mostly. You're right.
Yeah, I don't have a beef with her. Like, I mean, I don't really have a beef with any of the cast. I just felt like it just didn't belong. Now, the biggest problem with this movie is there's no fucking plot. Like, it's just goofy scene after goofy scene, and there's just nothing to really hang your hat on here. Like, I didn't really feel like they were really like doing anything.
So, like, how much of the actual original movie did they bring back into the fold here?
Minimal. Like, there was no, like, there's all kinds of course, there's all kind of references to it.
Right.
Stupid fucking Slimer shows up, and
yeah.
Which I just was like, come on, like, don't. And the marshmallow guy, like, really, like, again, it's just like, it was fucking infuriating. And then you've, on top of that, you've got, like, this villain who's, like, kind of supposed to, like, if you're looking at the No, I can't even compare it to the original. Anyway, this was a lame villain. Crazy guy who's like trying to like, you know, open the gates of the ghost world or whatever. And it just didn't work at all. Like, I didn't like this guy at all. Thankfully, he didn't make it through the whole movie. And then you've got Hemsworth, Chris Hemsworth. So the good Hemsworth. But he, again, like he's playing their secretary.
He's kind of playing the Annie Potts character.
No, he's not, because no. Annie Potts was not a fucking moron.
Oh, okay.
Annie Potts, I thought, was a pretty cool secretary. Yeah, she was a secretary, but I didn't feel like she was an idiot.
No.
This guy is an idiot.
Okay.
And I think, like, the whole thing is, ho, 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 look at us. We're turning...
Look at that hot guy. He's stupid.
Yeah, we're turning everything on its head, because look at he's playing the guy, the role the girl should usually play. Ha, ha, ha.
Look at us. We're so witty reversing genders.
But I was like, what's the point of this? And then, you know, and then, spoiler alert, he gets possessed, and then he's kind of the bad guy, and I'm like... Okay, this is, like, really not helping me at all. And he was kind of the best part, but only because he kind of knows how to carry a big movie, because he's played fucking Thor, right? But I just... My biggest thing with this is just there was nothing... There was no... Like, in the original Ghostbusters, which also I didn't like that much... It's got a bit of a special place because it was the right place, right time. But I don't think it was a particularly good movie. But at least in that movie, you had Bill Murray kind of falling for Sigourney Weaver. Yeah. Shit happens to her. He's got a reason to, like, try and defeat Zool or whatever his name was.
Right.
Right? So at least you're, like, kind of, like, holding on to this plot point that's kind of making you care about what happens. There was none of that in this. There was no romance anywhere that I saw, and I was just like not interested at all in what happened. I was just fucking waiting for it to end. Like, I was like, please God, let this end. And it would just not. It just
that
kept
is
going
the worst
and going
thing.
And going. And I'm like, oh my God. And then the other thing about it is like the Leslie Jones character, like, we're supposed to be giving strong female performances, and I just felt like it was totally racist. Like, you've got this, the one black character, she's not a scientist. This has all been talked about before, I'm sure. She's the only one who's not a scientist. She's working, you know, in the transit authority. You know, she's like one of the subway ticket takers. For whatever reason, she decides to, someone walks past her ticket booth and then walks into the subway tunnel. So she fucking follows him and sees a ghost and then quits her job and joins the Ghostbusters. Doesn't make any sense. And she, you know, again, it's that same black thing that I saw in that Sasquatch movie. Exists.
Yep.
Like, you know, when the shit starts hitting the fan, she stops talking normal. She starts saying, "Where you at?
Oh, shit.
Where you at?
Where you at, ghost? I'm gonna pop a cap in your motherfucking ass."
Yeah, like, it's just like, why did you need to do that? Like, I find that behavior so weird.
Yeah.
But I can't even go on a rant on this just because it's just not worth it.
Okay.
I hated this fucking thing. Like,
which is funny because you told me that the person you were with absolutely loved it.
A lot of kids seem to love this movie.
Strange.
It's not just him. A lot of kids love it.
Strange.
I don't know. I mean, again, it's like I was talking at the beginning, though. Like, is it just a timing thing? Maybe I would have loved it when I was 12. I don't think so. Well, I might have. I mean, the stuff I was loving when I was 12, who knows, right? But this is...
I used to love the Goonies.
This is a...
Believe me, I've tried to
on the Goonies.
I've tried to watch the Goonies as an adult. It just annoys the fuck
Goonies
out of me.
Goonies is terrible.
Yeah, it annoys me immensely.
Yeah, if anyone ever...
We lost some listeners, dude.
What?
We lost some listeners.
Sorry, listeners. And if anyone ever compares Stranger Things to the Goonies, do not listen to them.
Yeah.
The other thing is there was cameos in this movie. Of Bill Murray shows up, Dan Aykroyd shows up, Annie Potts shows up, and Ernie Hudson shows up, and Sigourney Weaver shows up. None of whom are playing the characters they played in the original. They're all in different roles. What the fuck was that all about? Like, it wasn't... Like, Bill Murray has a, like, substantial role. Why wouldn't he play Peter Venkman? I don't get it. Like, I think they could have, like, taken that in a completely different direction. Anyway, this is just misguided on all fronts. Way too fucking long and lame. And I feel really bad for Kristen Wiig.
Okay.
Anyway, at least they're not making a sequel. Because
it
bombed, I think.
Fair enough.
I think it made some money, but it I don't think it was a success.
I don't think it made as much money as they were hoping.
No.
Because I know they did call off the sequel. So.
Yeah.
Anyway. I've got two movies and I'm going to talk about my two movies because you still got like eight.
Yeah.
So let's talk about mine.
All right.
And the funny thing is, and I realize this now when I'm looking down, is they both kind of had the same theme behind them.
Ooh.
So first movie I watched, because, you know, TCM, they sometimes play some cool stuff and, you know, sometimes they play some not so cool stuff, but you can always count on them to play something that I haven't seen. And I'd never seen Roger Corman's The Wasp Woman.
No, until, I've never seen that either.
Yeah, so it's a 1959 movie. Basic premise of it is about a lady played by Susan Cabot. She plays Janice Starlin, who runs Starlin Cosmetics, who, you know, she figures out a way that she can get injected with royal jelly from wasps to keep her young.
I think, but I saw this when it was called Evil Spawn.
Yeah, but of course there's side effects, and, you know, it makes her into a wasp-headed killer woman.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's your typical 50s science fiction movie. You know, a lot of talking in it. It was remade by Jim Wynorski in 1996 with Jennifer Rubin in the title role.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie was kind of a reaction to The Fly, which came out the year prior.
Okay.
Because, you know,
it's version.
Very similar looking monster in this. Like, because in The Fly, it's the scientist with a fly head.
Yeah.
In this movie, it's Janice Starlin with a wasp head.
Okay.
I would have much preferred if it was like the poster, which was like, the poster is an awesome hand-drawn poster of a wasp body with a woman's head on it.
Oh,
yeah,
I know.
Much
poster,
preferred
yeah.
that. I think, of course, obviously, with a budget of whatever it was, peanuts, Corman couldn't have pulled that off, but I would have preferred that. The mask is silly. Like all 50s monster movies, it's, you know, the effects aren't exactly write home about in any of these movies, but, you know, kind of fun in a way.
Yeah.
Susan Cabot, who plays the main character, she's pretty awesome in this.
Great.
You know, she's kind of bitchy, but at the same time, once she starts injecting this royal jelly and starts going a little bit crazy, I really liked her, and this was actually her last movie she was ever in.
Why?
I don't know. I wasn't able to figure that out, but she, it seems like she was kind of like a Corman franchise, like a just like a contract player with Corman.
Right.
Because before this, most of what she was in was either directed or produced by Roger.
Okay.
So it seems like she was just like a stable player. So maybe she just fell out of interest with acting or
yeah.
something along those lines. It happens.
Yeah.
But I thought she was really good in it. Like I said, I feel like it was a reaction to The Fly, because there's even a scene in it where there's a character going, "Help me, help me." So I was like, okay, make it a little bit obvious what you're hitting off on here.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, it is what it is. It wasn't exactly the most exciting 50s monster movie I've ever seen. It's from the same guy who wrote Attack of the Giant Leeches.
Okay.
Which I thought was a more entertainingly goofy movie than this. Jack Hill apparently has some uncredited direction on this.
Right, okay.
Because they expanded it with a little bit more dialogue and stuff, and he apparently came in and did that.
Jack Hill directed The Big Dollhouse and Switchblade Sisters.
Exactly, yeah. And Spider Baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was pretty good. It's if you're into 50s monster movies and you like Roger Corman, we've talked about him in the past. Obviously, we had an episode about him.
Yeah.
It is essential viewing for Roger Corman's sake, because this
Corman directed this, right?
He did.
Yeah.
And this gives you a big picture of what he was doing in that decade and why he was able to make these movies cheap and build a career making these producing movies like this throughout the 60s and 70s that got him lots of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, Wasp Woman, I recommend seeing it if you're into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it's 70 minutes long.
Yeah.
Doesn't overstay its welcome. It's got a decent lead performance by Susan Cabot, like I said. And, you know, it's goofy.
Nice.
It's goofy. The next movie, and the reason I'm saying...
I think I'll stick with Evil Spawn.
Yeah, well, Evil Spawn might be kind of a riff on this.
Sounds it's a total remake.
Total remake, okay. And after that, I watched 2002's Infested.
Yes.
Which is about killer house flies.
Yeah.
So we kind of...
I was looking at the cover for this earlier.
I kind of got a unintentional insect run going on there. Killer insect run. I didn't plan it that way.
Was this just a Dollarama?
No, this was a thrift store, like
okay.
dollar at the thrift store kind of deal. And the reason this interests me is it's written and directed by Josh Olson. He's kind of doesn't have a huge name in the movie circles. He adapted the graphic novel A History of Violence for David Cronenberg in 2005. He shows up a lot on that Trailers from Hell website that Josh and I enjoy.
Yeah,
where it has filmmakers discussing movie trailers. If you haven't been there, you should check that out.
Yeah, for sure.
What this is it's best way to describe Infested is that it's like Josh Olson really loves The Big Chill from 1983.
What?
And decided to make a monster like a killer insect movie with the basis of The Big Chill in the background.
Is this for real?
For real, dude. The setup of this is that the setup for this is that...
Like, is this known? Did he say this?
It's fucking obvious. Just let me explain this and you'll know. Okay, so somebody dies. All of their past friends get together and decide to go to a cabin for the weekend.
Oh my God.
To be nostalgic about their dead friend.
Wow.
While oldies play in the background.
No.
Yes. This is The Big Chill. There is even a dance scene.
No.
Where they put a record on the turntable in the living room and dance to it, and it's that song "A Da Da Da" by Trio. Okay. Josh Olson fucking loves The Big Chill. Okay.
Apparently.
The addition to The Big Chill is that there's killer flies around, which are not explained, that like to fly into people's mouths, possess them, and turn them into zombie-like creatures.
Sold.
So someone will have these flies, which are bad CG, pour into their mouths and then proceed to make them do walk like zombies and attack their friends.
But it's got Billy in it.
Yes, it's got Zach Galligan from Gremlins in it as a kind of douchey television series actor.
Really?
Yes. So the thing I got to say about Infested, the first person who gets gets taken over by these bugs, at least right before she does, she comes out of the ocean topless. So at least we've got that going for us, right? But she gets possessed. They go back to the house. She possesses another guy. They decide to attack everyone else in the house. Everyone else in the house just fully accepts the fact that these people are acting weird and want to kill them. They're like, what happened to them? They just want to kill us. They don't never do that. They're just like, oh, they're out there. They're trying to kill us. We better stay in here. They'll like basically have a fist fight with these people who are possessed by these killer house flies. And one of them gets like their head caved in and so on and so forth. And I'm just sitting there going, this is fucking ridiculous.
Why is it?
Yeah.
That whenever you review like the shittiest movies,
I make them sound good.
I always want to watch them.
Well, okay. So
I still have that one with the fucking bears on the planet that I want to watch too.
Don't watch that, dude. But anyway, it's like Josh Olson, when he's not busy jerking off over The Big Chill, he decides to put these killer flies in it. And they're just really badly rendered CG. Cause this is a 2002 movie. So this is like kind of at that cusp where CG is like, not as bad as it once was, but not as good as it kind of...
I can't even believe we went through that era. Poor us.
I know. And it's like...
Poor you for still being in that era.
There's some, like, okay practical gore here. Like, there's a scene with Zach Galligan's character, like, cutting into his wound in his leg. That's kind of gross, but it's kind of... You can tell it's practical effects. So you're like, okay, this is cool. It's stupid, but it's cool. It's trying way too hard to be a cult movie.
Right.
Because it's got like that kind of hip kind of like sarcastic dialogue to it. Kind of like, you know, and the characters are kind of
like early 90s Kevin Smithy.
Yeah, it's like that early 2000s hipster shit. It's got Amy Jo Johnson in it, who played the Pink Ranger on Mighty Morphin Power Rangers back in the day.
Did you watch the Power Rangers?
I didn't, but that's the main reason people would watch this movie. She has a shower scene in this movie, but you don't see anything.
Oh.
So it's kind of pointless. However, you do see a bunch you do see a bunch of flies pour out of the drain at her while she's in the shower. So I'm like, okay, that's cool. And there is a scene where one of the possessed people pukes blood all in her face, which led her to have the shower in the first place.
Oh, okay.
So that's okay. But this is just a dumb
movie.
So
he even made an excuse for the shower scene and still fucking dropped the ball.
Yeah. It's a dumb movie.
Okay, well, I'm going to watch it.
You probably will. It's just... Like, there's moments in it I kind of liked certain things about it. Like, you know, apart from it being an obvious ripoff of, like, a beloved 80s drama.
Yeah.
And, you know, having that really poor, poor CG. It's maybe a little bit poorer than that movie Stung we talked about in the past a few episodes ago. It's a little bit below that level. But it's not on a level where after I watched it, I was like, oh, fuck, what have I done?
Okay.
So, you know, it was not great, but when I was watching it, I was like, okay, that's 84 minutes. I'll never get back. But I wasn't that pissed off about it.
Wasn't The Big Chill Barry Sonnenfeld, right?
No, it was Lawrence Kasdan.
Okay. What did Barry Sonnenfeld do?
Men in Black? Adam's Family?
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
No, because he's got this new movie out that looks terrible. But...
No, Lawrence Kasdan's the guy who did, like, Grand Canyon and...
Oh, all those, like, dramas.
He did all those, like, we're getting old dramas. He did kind of those. But yeah,
right.
I can't recommend Infested, to be honest with you. But I know you're going to fucking watch it anyway, so it doesn't matter what I say.
Well, I am now. I wasn't going to.
So, but... You know, like I said, it's got its moments, but overall...
I want to see the dance scene.
Overall, it's general. Oh, dude, you just reminded me. Speaking of that, there's a really fucking stupid scene later that brings back the dance scene to do with the zombie creatures that is unbelievable.
Oh my god,
it's fucking stupid.
Oh, I can't wait to watch this. Okay,
you can report to us later what you thought. That's all I got. So let's hit your gigantic list and try and get this done in the next like half an hour, so we don't end up having like another 3.5 hour double episode.
Well,
like
I just don't want to skip over a bunch because I'm not going to come back to them.
Well,
ever.
Don't skip. Let's just you know try not to talk about things for 25 minutes like we did with Stranger Things.
Lake Placid versus
not that it wasn't worth 25 minutes. What?
Lake Placid versus Anaconda.
Okay, yeah. Okay, people, if you're a regular listener of this podcast, please rewind to the episode where we heard Josh saying, "So, here's Chris. So, Josh, are you ever going to watch Lake Placid versus Anaconda?" Fuck no, I'm done with this series. Okay, continue. Continue.
I don't know what. It was one of those moments of weakness surfing Amazon late at night.
And how much was it?
It was like $10.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm justifying. I never want to see this movie.
Hopefully
$10, okay.
I can sell it on eBay.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck, jackass. Fuck.
At least it's the end of the series. There's nothing more to watch.
You know what they should make? Lake Placid versus Anaconda versus Boa. Remember those fucking movies?
Oh, Boa. Yeah. Or Python.
Python. Remember Boa versus Python?
We could throw Komodo in while we're at it.
Oh, Boa versus Python versus Komodo versus Anaconda versus Lake Placid.
Wasn't there a Boa versus Python already?
There was. Yeah. Boa versus Python versus Anaconda versus...
Mecha Shark.
Frankenfish. I fucking love Frankenfish, though, but that's just me. Okay, go on.
Robert
Sharknado.
Robert Englund returns in Lake Placid versus Anaconda.
Robert Englund needed some lunch money.
So the movie opens up with a bunch of scientists, and I guess they've been developing...
Scientists, get the fuck out of here.
Killer snakes in, of course, Lake Placid territory. And then this... They're developing...
Why?
I don't know why.
Are they going to send it to Afghanistan?
I'm not.
They're going to fucking airlift in some snakes and drop them into like ISIS headquarters?
I'm not.
Like, seriously.
I'm not. Sorry, I saw Jim Wynorski Facebook post today, and he put up a picture of ISIS, you know, the 1970s TV show, and he's like, there should be a movie called ISIS versus ISIS. It was classic. If you know what ISIS is, it would be pretty awesome.
Okay,
so
anyway.
Thanks, Jim, for the comedy. Anyway, Robert Englund returns, and he's in this. That he's trying to sell something. I don't even know what was going on at the beginning. But
as we can tell, John really paid attention.
Yeah, I really pay attention to the plot in these movies. So anyway, there's these scientists developing these like mutant snakes, and of course shit goes down and the snakes escape, and now all of a sudden in the Lake Placid territory there is now, you know, mutant crocodiles as well as mutant.
How did they become mutants?
Mutant snakes. What?
The crocodiles.
Weren't they always mutants? They're giant.
Maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen Lake Placid.
And they're CG, so they look like mutants.
I'd only seen Lake Placid 1, and that was so long ago, I've forgotten everything.
The whole series can fucking blow me, but except for maybe part 3. Part 2 wasn't bad either. Anyway.
Yet you're keeping that Blu-ray of the original.
It's Scream Factory.
I know. Whatever.
I'm keeping part 3.
Okay,
I would be keeping part 2 if it wasn't the rated version.
Maybe John Voight should show up in this movie.
Oh, God. Okay. Lake Placid 4 is already sold. Just say no.
Don't hassle the Hoff. He was in Anaconda.
No, you know who the star of this movie is?
Who?
Do you remember that show Parker Lewis Can't Lose?
Corin Nemec?
He's the male lead.
Oh, fuck this movie in the ass.
And Yancey Butler, of course, returns.
Fucking Corky Nemec?
Corin Nemec, yeah.
Nobody gives a shit about him.
I knew.
Is this a sci-fi movie?
I don't know.
Is the Asylum made this movie? Because they're the ones who trot out the fucking people you haven't heard from like 20 years.
Well, Yancey Butler's been in all of them so far.
Oh, fuck.
Except for the first one. But, and Yancey Butler's character, for whatever reason, so she started
It's not the same character?
She started as like a redneck in like part 3, I think. Then in part 4, she was like a conservation officer. Now she's the sheriff.
Okay.
And it's the same character.
I'm having a very...
So I don't know how she keeps getting promoted.
I'm having a very hard time wrapping my head around the fact that there's 5 fucking Lake Placid movies.
No, there's four, and this is a team-up movie. This is Lake Placid versus
Anaconda. Yeah, but technically it's Anaconda. A sequel. It's technically a sequel. People
well, how many
count...
Anaconda? There's like four Anaconda
yeah,
movies.
Yeah, so this is the fifth Anaconda movie. But people technically count Freddy versus Jason as a sequel.
Well,
so...
and the other thing is Lake Placid, the original, is a terrible movie, as I've already talked about.
Yeah.
So we've got nine shitty movies here in a row.
Dude, ten.
Ten?
There's five Anacondas.
No, there's not.
Yeah. There's Anaconda 1 through 4, and then there's this one.
Is there one? I stopped at Blood Orchid.
David Hasselhoff's in 3 and 4, dude.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, I guess where I'll probably be.
And you know what's sad? You said there's 10 shitty movies. Hunt for the Blood Orchid's okay.
Yeah, Hunt for the Blood Orchid's okay.
Anaconda 1 can go fuck itself. But Hunt for the Blood Orchid's okay.
I'm sorry to say, I'm probably going to revisit the Anaconda
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I just need to go full circle here.
You know, this reminds me that all you did when you said that is, like, I'm not a huge Radiohead fan, but I had that God. Line from that song coming out. You did it to yourself, you do.
Don't sing Radiohead. I hate Radiohead.
Yeah.
There goes another 20 listeners.
Yeah. Wow.
They're geniuses. They're geniuses.
Fucking Radiohead. Yeah.
You get Paul Feig together with Radiohead, and there's a kick-ass movie.
No. Hang on, do that and I'll do it. Calm down. Okay, so
Oh my god. So
Robert Englund, Yancey Butler,
Radiohead,
mutant snakes. And
oh my
fucking
god,
Anacondas.
I think my eardrum just imploded. Okay, what? Okay.
Yancey Butler is now the sheriff.
Okay, so the movie starts...
It reminds me of Suzanne Summers. She's the sheriff. Oh, yeah.
So the movie starts to get going, and like, okay, so pretty close to, after the snakes get out, we're introduced to this, like, runaway girl, and I guess she's runaway. And
runaway train never comes.
Anyway, she's not in the movie very long because she, like...
She gets eaten.
She gets naked.
And then she gets eaten.
And then she, like, has sex with this guy who, like, comes to her house.
So but, he gave her a ride because yeah, she's a runaway.
So she's riding him, and unbeknownst to her, there's a crocodile under the bed.
Crikey.
Under the bed.
What's he doing?
So they're having
the
sex, and then, like, there's
does the mattress, like, hit the crocodile on the top of the head?
There's a shot under the bed where the mattress is in the
It's fucking awesome. Sold.
It's so funny. Okay, so then...
Calm down, breathe.
It's a Radiohead thing, man. Oh, shit. Okay, so then we go to the lake. And this time around, we've got... So it's a little better than the last few setups. Because at least this time, we've got a bunch of sorority pledges that are at the lake.
Okay.
That are being, like, made to go into the water and stuff.
I'm in.
But,
okay.
Yeah, so there's a lot of good bikini shots and stuff. That's probably the best part about
this
movie.
Sold right now, yeah.
There's a... Yeah, the bitch, like, leader of the sorority is quite... She's well played and stuff, but then, you know, you've got, like... Corin Nemec's daughter, she's like the good girl who
I'd like to refer to him as Corky from now on.
Parker. Who
Parker.
Who does she doesn't really know why she's
apparently we've learned that over years Parker Lewis can fucking lose.
He was alright in this.
Okay, well, anyway. Daughter, yeah. She's a sorority pledge.
So she's sorority pledge, but she doesn't really know why she's there.
Okay. I've come to the conclusion that if there's sorority pledges in movies, I'm totally uninterested unless you're Dave DeCoutu and you've had them getting paddled in their underwear like sorority babes in the slime ball bowler.
But these aren't so most of the pledges that are like prancing around are pretty vapid, right? Like they're the typical, you know, taking their tops off, rubbing lotion on each other pledges. No, they got fake boobs and stuff.
Okay,
I'm not
so sold.
I don't like fake
Go
boobs.
On.
Anyway, but
fuck,
but
we sound perverted.
No, I'm just, I didn't sound perverted. I don't like fake boobs.
I do.
What?
Anyway, go on.
I'm on a cloud. Okay, so Corin Nemec's daughter, let's call her a name. Did I write down her name? I don't think I did.
Well, you didn't even know what the plot is, so why would you write down her daughter's name?
Anyway, Parker's daughter I wrote down. Anyway, she's there. I don't really know why I'm here. I don't really want
Parker
to be
Lewis apparently can't wear condoms either.
Apparently not. So then she meets up with this goth chick. And yep. What the fuck? Like, no goth chick I know would be pledging for a fucking sorority. Plus, this goth chick looks like she's like 30. So I'm like, what the fuck? So they
Yancy Butler undercover.
It's not Yancy Butler.
Just kidding.
And Yancy Butler, yeah, she's the sheriff.
She's the sheriff.
And it was just really awkward, like, dynamic because like this goth chick clearly does not belong here at all, and clearly the actress is not a goth chick. So it's one of those situations.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then they're just sort of like, I don't know why I'm here. Neither of us know why we're here. Ooh, we've had a bad family life.
You're there to be fucking eaten by crocodiles.
And then the crocodiles attack, and things happen, and that's about it.
Where's the verses come into play?
Well, I gotta say the anacondas are pretty badass because they can just go around a crocodile and break them in half.
Okay, so like,
and they can also go around cars and crush the cars.
So, do the anacondas attack people?
Yep.
So the anacondas and the crocodiles are attacking humans.
But the anacondas seem kind of good in a way. Like they're kind of like.
What do you mean they're good? They're killing people.
They're not like the alligators. They're like or crocodiles. They're like better than they like come and save the day a few times. The anacondas.
What the fuck are you talking about?
It doesn't make any sense.
How do they come and save the day?
Well, like you know, like the crocodile is about to eat someone, and then the anaconda will come out of nowhere and wrap itself around the crocodile and break its back.
But maybe the anaconda is killing the crocodile so they can kill the person.
That might be the case, but that's not what happens.
So what? They just like come and kill the crocodile and the people just fucking stroll away?
I think so. We haven't been together in like a month and this is the first movie I have written down. Just, it's shitty. Don't see it. One good thing is there's...
Dude, unlike you, I'm not going to go on Amazon and pay $10 for this piece of shit.
You just don't pay $10 for this one.
What were you going to say? What did I just do?
There's another actress in this, Annabelle Wright. She plays like this villain and they're like... I don't know what they're doing. Like, it's like,
and where's Robert Englund in all this?
They're trying to get the snakes back because the snakes because
they want to attack
are
ISIS.
Valuable or something.
But why is
ISIS has nothing to do with
so
it?
So what's Robert Englund doing?
He's like
he's just kind of in the background.
He's in the other
around.
Movies. It's a continuing character from the other.
He's
movies.
In the background shaking his head. He's like, fuck! I wish I was in a Freddy movie.
It's
right now.
Sad.
Yeah.
It's
he
sad.
Was in another movie called Black Swarm with about killer fucking wasps.
Robert Englund, man. Like he's a good actor. He doesn't need to do shit
man.
Like
he
this.
Was fucking Benny and V, man.
Yeah. He's a good actor. Yeah. Doesn't need to do stuff like this.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, so that's a... Finally, he's done after telling me he wasn't going to watch it, so...
Well, now... But good. Now I have to go watch the Anaconda movies.
Good on you. Have fun with that shit.
The Shrine.
Okay.
2010. Do you know this one?
I know of it. I've seen a movie the guy who made it did in the past.
Yes.
He did, what the fuck was it called?
So John Knotts is the director. I know him from making a movie called Jack Brooks Monster Slayer.
Yeah. He made something else too, but I can't remember.
He made another movie called Girl House that looks pretty interesting, but okay. I haven't seen it. Anyway, this is pretty good.
It's a Canadian movie, right?
Yeah, he's a Canadian director. Yeah, okay. I saw this on Netflix.
I have the DVD at home from Dollarama.
You own this?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. It's got, you know, it gets you in the mood pretty quick. It's got a really kind of cool opening credit sequence. It's just titles, but it's pretty moody and different. And then we see this guy getting sacrificed by like this religious cult. So anyway, we cut to like...
Isn't it set in like some European country too?
Yeah, it looked like...
Poland or somewhere?
Czech Republic or something. Okay. Yeah, or Poland, yeah. Somewhere over there. Somewhere Eastern Europe.
Okay.
But we cut to this, like we cut to an American town and we've got this girl. She's a reporter named Carmen, played by Cindy Sampson. And she's caught wind of this story where these people are going missing in this small European town. So she decides she wants to investigate this story. So she ropes in another girl that works at the paper she's at and her boyfriend, and off they go to Prague or wherever they're going. So when they get there, it's the usual, you know, people going into a small town in Europe like Wicker Man. I think we talked about this in another podcast recently about another movie like this. Because I remember saying, you know, don't ever go into a, if you ever go into a small town in Europe and people start looking at you, finally you get the fuck out. Because yeah. It's kind of the same thing.
Kind of like Gymkhana.
Kind of like Gymkhana. Yeah. So
what a comparison.
It's one of those movies where, yeah, like it's just this weird town and everyone's being kind of weird. And, you know there's something going on. When it's already kind of been established that there's this weird religious cult in the town. And then they also discover that there's this area just outside the town where there's this mist, like kind of in the forest.
Okay.
So they go in and, of course, they go and investigate the mist like a bunch of dumbasses. And it turns out that if you go into the mist, then there's this weird like statue of like kind of a demon. Kind of looks like that demon statue in The Exorcist, you know, but a giant version of it. So a couple of them go and see this demon in the mist. And then... the movie just sort of meanders along. The town people want them gone. One of the townspeople is this like big kind of burly guy who's like swings an axe around a lot and you know, is slaughtering animals. I think he's like a butcher or something. Anyway, it's actually Jack Brooks. I didn't even recognize him, the guy who plays Jack Brooks.
Oh, okay.
I think they're kind of a filmmaking team, kind of like Astron 6 or something like that. But and then eventually the movie kind of turns into it is a cult movie. Not a cult movie, but it's like a movie about cults. But it also is a bit of a possession movie as well. But I thought it was really quite well done, really atmospheric. I don't want to give away a lot about the plot. But, yeah, I'd say check it out.
It's like 80-some minutes. Pretty short.
It's pretty short. It's a 2010 movie. And, yeah, it's...
Yeah,
it's,
this is one that I...
worth a look.
I know it was on Netflix, but then when we were doing our big $2 horror movie DVD buy... In October, this is when I was like, okay, might as well.
It's almost October again, buddy.
Oh, fuck.
How many of those do you have left that you haven't watched?
All of them?
Yeah, I've got like 40 or something.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, you guys will hear about that in October, I'm sure.
Oh, my God. I wonder if it's like that every year, isn't it?
Dude, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, good old Dollarama.
We just go there in October because we know they have the horror movies, and we're like, this looks like shit, $2, okay.
Anyway, if you see a movie called The Shrine,
yes,
it's worth picking up.
I like the cover art of it.
I didn't like the cover art.
I kind of like it because it's kind of like it's like a girl with like a bloody sheet over her head.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of cool. Kind of mysterious.
I had heard a few good things about this. Like, I don't think I would have checked it out normally, but I had heard a few people say that, you know, this is like a decent, you know, recent horror movie. And it was.
Okay,
it was good.
Cool.
It was fun.
So it's good to find those movies that are kind of like low budget that you really have heard nothing about that actually turn out to like go beyond your expectations. So that's cool.
Yeah. I mean, this wasn't blowing my socks off or anything, but it was certainly an enjoyable way to spend 90 minutes. Yeah. Like
perfect.
I wasn't pissed off and it was well acted, well directed.
It's no Ghostbusters.
Okay. I've also made a few other trips to the theater.
To the theater.
But these were actually good trips.
You've been doing some good retrospective.
Oh, I got lots of theater
trips. You've done some retrospective trips.
Yeah. Actually, I think the rest of my stuff is all theater.
And they were all when I was on vacation.
Yeah. Theater visits.
So I didn't get to go.
Like you'd go.
A little teardrop. I would have went to some of these, yeah.
Okay. So my first trip to the theater. My most recent trip to
the theater. Stop trying to make it sound friggin'... We went to the theater
We
saw Radiohead.
It's that the time has passed.
You do it to yourself, you do.
Okay, computer.
I get it. You fucking paranoid android.
Don't be a creep. Oh, why do we know so much?
Jesus Christ.
Okay, I saw The Elephant Man.
Wicked.
So The Elephant Man from 1980.
David Lynch's best movie.
Pretty
close.
Yeah.
His best movie when he's not being a weirdo.
Yeah, I like Wild at Heart a lot. But
yeah.
But this is a masterpiece.
Yeah. I'm not arguing with you.
So this is Lynch's second movie after Eraserhead. And this is the story of John Merrick. In real life, his name was Joseph Merrick. Who is a abnormality? Who was a man who was deformed, bluntly, and had some serious physical issues. And it's the story of him. It's basically his a short period in his life before he died. And it starts out where he's basically part of a carnival sideshow. And Anthony Hopkins plays a doctor who decides he wants to try and help this man. So he brings him to the hospital and befriends him and tries to protect him and have him live out the rest of his life in some sort of peace. And he can't really find a cure for him, but he can certainly make his life a little better. And it's just mainly about their relationship. The Elephant Man is played by John Hurt, completely unrecognizable, obviously, because he's buried under thick makeup. Anne Bancroft also shows up in this. She's always so fucking cool, man, Anne Bancroft. She doesn't have a big part in this, but a pretty substantial part. I know Lynch tried to make this somewhat true to life with a lot of what was going on. But, you know, there was some stretching going on as far as the exploitation of the Elephant Man. There were some things that happened in this movie that didn't happen in real life, but there are some things that did happen in real life. But it's just such a well-acted movie. It's just, it was awesome because when I went to saw this movie, it was a film print. So it brought me back to The Warriors because it was a little bit scratchy and jumpy and, but it really kind of added to the experience. And, this was shot in black and white and, yeah, it's just a real piece of work, and it's always made an impression on me. I remember seeing this very young, probably around 11. You know, when other kids go to Ghostbusters, I was going to the Elephant Man. But yeah, it really kind of struck me then, and it's always kind of been with me. It's been in my top five movies of all time for a long time. I've never seen it on the big screen. Real treat to see it there. Some interesting facts. I know that Mel Brooks executive produced this, and Mel Brooks is pretty much the reason that Lynch got hired, and he's also the reason that this was shot in black and white. So kudos to Mel. I mean, people often think of Mel as a comic with silly movies, and I know, Chris, you're a big fan, but it's stuff like this that, you know...
Well, he's also responsible for Cronenberg's The Fly. Yeah. He produced that. So, you know, Brooks films actually, you know, it's like you said, you think of Mel Brooks, you just think of, like, schmaltzy comedy, but under Brooks Films, he made movies like The Fly and The Elephant Man.
So this is I don't know. This isn't really out on DVD either. It came out briefly.
Yeah, it was like a Paramount DVD, and then it kind of disappeared. This is like a movie that needs a Criterion.
Yeah, like Blu-ray. I don't understand what the problem is. Like,
Criterion could put out Eraserhead, they can put out Elephant Man.
It really does need a serious restoration and proper release, because it's such a great movie, and it really is. You know, I know some people have criticized this as being a little too, like, not melodramatic, but a little too, like, you know, feely. Like, it kind of pulls at the heartstrings a bit, but I think it's justified. I never felt like that when watching this. Kenny Baker, RIP. So yeah, Kenny Baker died this week, actually. R2-D2 aka, but also a small actor who played in a lot of pretty cool movies, this being one of them. Didn't have a big role in this, but it's definitely a substantial role. The makeup was by Christopher Tucker. He did Company of Wolves. But I think the main thing I know Christopher Tucker from is the giant fat guy in Monty Python's Meaning of Life.
Oh, yeah.
It was a pretty great gag. But, I mean, the makeup in this was awesome. I'm not nominated for a makeup Oscar, but the reason the makeup Oscar exists was because of this makeup job, because people were so outraged that he didn't get an Academy Award nomination that they made that category the next year. But, yeah, I absolutely recommend checking this out if you've never seen it before. And, but it is a little hard to find these days. So.
How was the attendance?
It was okay.
Because, you know, we rag on Vancouver a lot because we're from Vancouver, but we're justified in ragging on Vancouver when they show a movie like The Elephant Man and they can't even fill the house.
Definitely not a full house. So, no, there was, like, because I was in the third row and there was two people in front of me.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And, but it's typical Vancouver. I mean, you play, what's something? Well, actually, Holy Mountain did really well, which I'm going to talk about next.
Yeah.
That was packed when I saw that.
Yeah.
It's weird. Like,
it's weird how it works. Cause like when we went and saw Warriors, it was full house pretty much. When I went and saw The Birds,
yeah,
it was a pretty full house. But then I go at Christmas time and I see Miracle on 34th Street and there's like 8 people in the theater.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just weird. This city is weird for retrospective.
Well, I hate to say it, but if the hipsters kind of hook onto the movie, it's going to do well.
Yeah, I guess.
And
so.
I can see, especially with, we're going to get into it more in a sec, but with Jodorowsky's Dune.
Yeah.
I know people I've talked to about that movie that would never have seen El Topo or Holy Mountain
right.
had seen Jodorowsky's Dune. So I think what happened there is they saw Jodorowsky's Dune and then were like, oh.
Well, they saw it on Netflix and they're like, oh, Holy Mountain.
Who's this guy? Yeah. So that's what happened. But The Elephant Man, I mean, I don't know why. Like, I would think Lynch would be a bit of a culty director, but I don't know. I just don't think maybe. I don't know why people wouldn't go see that. It's interesting. I'm going to, because next week I'm going to be going to see A Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night.
Yeah,
on the
I saw
big
they
screen.
Were playing that.
And I'm curious what that kind of, because that. Anna Lily Amanpour is a bit of a hipster, I would say. And, you know, if we're going to be generalizing. So I would think she would appeal to that crowd a bit. So I'll be interested to see how that one does. But, yeah, check out The Elephant Man.
Definitely.
So might as well go right into Holy Mountain.
Yep.
So a 1973 film directed by Alejandro Jodorowsky. Have you seen Holy Mountain?
Yep.
You have?
Yep.
So I've seen Holy Mountain too, and I fucking did not remember anything.
Yeah, I saw it a long time ago, so I've kind of draw a blank on a lot of it too.
Yeah, now when I first saw it, both times I've seen this movie.
Super, I remember it being super surreal.
Yeah, I mean, it's a drug movie, right?
Yeah.
Let's be honest. But I mean, the first time I saw this movie, I was with a really, really drunk friend. Hi, Scott. and I was basically babysitting him through the whole movie. Like, he was so drunk. Like, so drunk. And I feel like I actually had to take him out of the theater and sit with him in the lobby for a while. But I actually talked to him recently, and I think we might have been in the theater the whole time. But I don't remember anything about this movie, I think, because I was so worried that this guy was going to barf. So don't remember much aside from a few scenes near the beginning. But I was really excited to see this in the theater again. And I'm really glad I did, because this is, it's one of those movies that's just so much going on. Like, it played again last week, and I kind of wish I had went to see it again, because I don't think I was, it's kind of like you talked about earlier about, like, how movies today are like a complete assault.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is kind of like that, but in a different way, because it's just so many layers and so much happening, and it's like scene after scene after scene of, like, just completely like bizarro stuff that's totally memorable as well, like that really strikes a chord with you. Like, it's images that are gonna kind of be burned in for a while, especially if you're paying attention and not babysitting a drunk person. I don't really know a lot of what it's about, other than a quest for understanding. And the movie opens with a guy called the Thief. Well, actually, the movie opens with Jodorowsky. He's playing this guy called the Alchemist, and he's an interesting looking dude. But there's these two women sitting in front of him, these two blonde women that kind of look like mannequins almost, and they're naked, and he pretty much shaves their heads on screen, and that's kind of the opening of the movie, and it's just a really surreal opening. Then we meet this guy called the Thief, who kind of looks like Jesus, and it's just about his quest for understanding. He is in this town. He befriends this like dwarf who's got no arms and legs, and then he like joins this kind of sideshow thing where there's like a big battle between lizards and frogs in this giant arena, and then he finds this giant tower. And he climbs the tower and then comes into this really weird, like, temple almost, where he meets the alchemist played by Jodorowsky. And eventually, you know, they start spending time together, and then the alchemist shows the thief that when he takes a shit, that the shit can be turned into gold. Of course, we see this all right in front of us on screen. Then we're introduced, then it starts getting into all this stuff like with tarot cards, and we're introduced to all these different people who are associated with planets, and then they all get together, and then they go on this quest to find the Holy Mountain. And yeah, it's just, I don't even know what else to say about the Holy Mountain. I do think everyone should see it. If you're into cult cinema and not just because you saw Jodorowsky's Dune, I think a lot of people that probably went to that and then tried to go to this would be like, what the fuck's going on? Yeah. I like El Topo way better. I do feel like it's El a little Topo more better. Linear.
Yeah.
But this is a movie I could see myself watching a number of more times in my life, just trying to get it. I heard the commentary on the box set's quite interesting by Jodorowsky. I think a lot of stuff gets explained in that. If you ever have a chance to see this on the big screen, I'd recommend it. Yeah. Alrighty.
Back to the theater.
The theater. Oh yeah, I saw The Shallows.
Yeah.
Not a lot to say about this shark movie, directed by Jaume Colet-Serra,
who made the really good Orphan.
Orphan and The House of Wax.
I really liked Orphan. House of Wax, not so much, but Orphan was a really cool movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen Orphan.
That was way better than I was expecting.
Yeah, I know you liked it when we talked about the crazy kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's basically Blake Lively, Ryan Reynolds' girlfriend, versus a shark. She goes surfing at a secluded beach, something I would never fucking do. And gets stuck out in the water after a bit of an incident with a shark, and can't really make her way back to shore, so she's stuck out trying to travel between different
boys,
like a boy and and a rock and a whale, basically, and trying to avoid the shark and figure out how to get out of the situation. It's a survival movie, pretty enjoyable. I definitely had a good time watching it. Not the best shark movie I've ever seen. There was a few things that happened in this where it's a little unbelievable, but I thought she carried the movie quite well, and definitely worth a check out on Netflix or on DVD when it comes out. And the last one I'm going to mention about that I saw in the theater was Bordello of Blood.
Yep. Never liked it.
I never liked it either, but I decided to go because I knew director Gilbert Adler and makeup effects artist Todd Masters were going to be in the house to talk about it. So I was looking forward to some Dennis Miller stories that I never got. But
that sucks.
Again, like as with most things, when I see it on the big screen, it's a better movie. And this is another case of that. Like I didn't hate it when I was watching it this time. I fucking hated Miller.
Well, there's so many stories associated with him in this movie, though.
It just feels like he was like,
like he was just saying fuck you to the entire movie.
Didn't want to be in the movie. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty well known.
Yeah.
And it was just him, like, he'd just pop up on screen and he'd be like cracking jokes, and then he'd be out and they'd go on to a different scene. It was just really weird. Like, so I don't know if all those jokes were unscripted. Like, it was just, he was just being a smarmy dick through the whole movie. And
I got to be honest with you, I've never really liked Dennis Miller.
No, I liked him on Weekend Update. I've always
kind of found him to be like smarmy.
Well, that was kind of his thing, though, yeah. Right? I didn't know he was such a like right wing conservative, but I mean, which he's, you know, I think that's what he's come out as. I can see why he didn't have a film career after this. And Erika Eleniak, she was also in this, and she was all right. I mean, Chris Sarandon was in this; he's always good. Angie Everhart, she's like the main vampire girl. And
it's funny that the only thing I can think of about Angie Everhart, she was like a supermodel, right?
Yeah. Sly's girlfriend.
Yeah, the only thing I can think about after Bordello's Blood is the fact that she starred in some terrible sequels to 9 and a Half Weeks.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she was in like another 9 and a Half Weeks and like 9 and a Half Weeks again or some bullshit like that.
10 and a Half Weeks.
Yeah. That's how pregnant she got when she slept with Mickey Rourke. Oh, no. I don't. Yeah.
What?
Never mind.
Was he in the sequels?
He was. I think he was in the first one, but I can't confirm.
Huh.
I'll confirm while you talk about.
I think he was doing Wild Orchid while the
sequel. Oh, dude, Wild. Don't talk about Zalman King movies in my presence.
What?
Red Shoe Diaries.
I like Zalman King movies.
Blue Sunshine? Didn't he star in Blue Sunshine?
He did. Did he direct Wild Orchid?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 9.5. Yeah. Anyway. It was the first 9.5 weeks was one of the sequels, I believe. I'm trying to figure this out. Talk a little bit
anyway,
more
the
about
best
Bordello
part about
here.
Bordello of Blood, you know, it was okay. I mean, it was a little better in the big screen scene with an audience and all that. There were some good effects in it, but yeah, I mean, it's no Demon Knight, let me put it that way. I mean, Demon Knight's definitely the superior Tales from the Crypt movie. I don't know if I'll want to buy the... I know Scream Factory put both of them out. I don't know if I'd buy this. I might buy it just because I heard that the extras on the movie are quite entertaining on the Scream Factory disc. But yep. I don't know if I'd watch the movie again.
I would probably buy the Demon Knight, but yeah, Bordello, nah.
Yeah, the best part of this was obviously hearing Gilbert Adler, who created or worked on most of the series. I think from season 2 on. And Todd Masters, who's done effects on tons of stuff. Just hearing them tell a bit of the making of the movie. And John Cassier showed up on Skype at the screening. And it was pretty fun watching him because he's able to go into Crypt Keeper voice, like, you know, on a dime. And that was pretty fun as well. So it was worth checking out for that. But I don't know if I'd... it's not that good of a movie.
And for my fact-checking... Mickey Rourke is in another 9.5 weeks.
Really?
With Angie Everhart. And it's directed by Anne Gersaud, who directed Embrace of the Vampire with Alyssa Milano and Poison Ivy 2 with Alyssa Milano.
Oh, wow. Well, there's that career.
So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to skip the rest.
Well, that reminded me of a movie I was going to bring up, but I'll not bother.
What?
I said Poison Ivy 2, and I watched Poison Ivy 1.
You did watch Poison Ivy 1.
Yeah, with Drew Barrymore and Sarah Gilbert.
Yeah.
Directed by Kat Shea Rubin.
Sarah Gilbert's in that? I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, it's a bad girl movie, you know, that psycho girl. So Sarah Gilbert's like the outcast at the high school who's befriended by Ivy, played by Drew Barrymore, who's kind of like that rebellious chick who's got the tattoo on her leg and everything.
Yeah.
Her dad is like a... stuffy kind of lawyer type.
Tom Skerritt.
And you know, Ivy's befriends Sarah Gilbert and worms her way into the family and starts seducing Tom Skerritt. And if you've ever wanted to see the funniest shit in the world, you will laugh your fucking bag off when you see Tom Skerritt going down on Drew Barrymore.
Does Tom Skerritt go down on her?
Down on Drew Barrymore. Oh. And the look, the real unbridled look of passion on Drew's face when Tom Skerritt's eating that clam.
Okay, stop. Come on.
Tom Skerritt, man. Fucking that mustache got to go. but this movie's
Tom
fun.
Skerritt was the captain in Alien, in case if anyone's trying to place him.
Poison Ivy is fucking hilarious.
I know.
Oh, my God.
I can't wait to watch my triple feature.
Oh, my God, dude. Holy shit. Kat Shea started her life off as an actress.
Yeah.
She was in Barbarian Queen, Stripped to Kill, what have you. And then Roger Corman decided to let her direct.
Kat Shea directed Stripped to Kill.
So she got a chance to direct by Roger Corman, the Stripped to Kill movies. Then she made Poison Ivy. She also made Dance of the Damned, which was... kind of a vampire movie that a lot of people seem to like. It's one of those existential vampire movies with like the stripper and the vampire having big long conversations about what life means to be immortal and shit.
Right. And she also made The Rage Carry 2, man.
Yeah, The Rage Carry 2, which is actually better than I remember. Yeah. I saw it recently. but anyway, Poison Ivy is fucking priceless. It's just one of those movies. Like, I love bad girl movies. They're terrible, but I love them.
I know.
You know, Tom Skerritt getting seduced by Drew, and there's just so many lines of dialogue in this movie that is so fucking hilarious.
Awesome.
There's a line like, fuck you with a limp dick. I'm like, what? and there's a scene in it where it's Sarah Gilbert has a narration through the movie, and she's like, she's talking about the Ivy character. She's like, She was the biggest slut I've ever seen, and she was my best friend. I just start laughing my ass off. I laughed my ass off through this whole movie. It's so fucking entertaining.
That's awesome.
So entertaining.
I can't wait to watch these again.
I'm going to watch Poison Ivy 2 with Alyssa Milano next.
You're nice. You got to watch Dearly Devoted as well, man.
Dude, I'm watching all four of the friggin' Poison. No, I hate that movie. I'm watching all four Poison Ivy movies. This is his preparation for our crazy girls.
Four?
Yeah, four, dude.
Or the Secret Society.
Hell yeah. I'm watching all these as preparation for our Crazy Girls episode. And my girlfriend and I, when we were on vacation, we're like, hey, we're on vacation. We should bring some movies with us. What do you want to take? We took Poison Ivy, Angel. Honor Student by Day.
Did you watch Angel?
Hollywood Hooker. No, Hollywood Hooker by Night. We took all that kind of classic cinema. We watched Poison Ivy, and we fucking loved it. And that's all I'm going to say.
And you didn't watch any of the other movies.
Yeah, but dude, Poison Ivy made up for all of it. It is so entertaining.
I forgot Tom Skerritt was in it.
It is so entertaining.
All right.
Because the mom is like dying too. And Tom Skerritt's like, my wife's dying. I'm going to go eat some clam.
Don't say that. Make you be uncomfortable.
You're welcome.
Like, who says that anymore? You're like a jock in an 80s movie.
I am, totally, dude. Yeah, I'm the kind of guy a jock in an 80s movie.
You're like probably. Andrew Dice Clay at a frat.
Oh!
You did that earlier, by the way.
Did I?
Yeah.
Sweet, sassy molassie. I don't even know what that is. I think I would probably get beaten up by jocks in 80s movies, actually. But that's besides the point. Let's move on.
I'll save the other two for next time.
All I gotta say is watch Poison Ivy. You won't regret it.
Oh, I'm going to.
Okay.
I'm gonna watch the triple feature.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
All in one night. I'm gonna binge that shit.
No, you have to watch four too. Do you have four?
The Secret Society?
Dude, I think I gave you the DVD of
you
four.
You did give me the DVD.
Because I bought the Blu-ray at Dollarama for $3.
Why?
Because it's the Secret Society, man.
It's not good though, man.
I don't know. I haven't seen it. It's got one of the girls from, like, Degrassi, The Next Generation plays Ivy in this one. How bad can it be?
Okay. Guess we're going to find out.
I guess so.
So, listeners, you can look forward to
hearing. Gird your loins for some Poison Ivy in the future.
Okay, let's. Okay, what time is it? I'm tired.
1:40. Let's do it.
We're at 1:40?
Yeah, let's do it.
Jesus Christ.
Dude, we were at 2.5 on the killer vehicles before we. Or deadly vehicles before we decided to split it.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not splitting this. Let's do it.
We gotta shorten this shit.
I know. We're long-winded. But I'm pretty sure 48
well,
episodes...
Hopefully there won't be a month fucking break next time.
I'm pretty sure 48 episodes in, people know that we talk a lot.
Well, isn't that what we're supposed to be doing?
Yes. We haven't had any complaints, so...
That's why it's called a podcast.
Exactly. Okay, let's talk about
now
Sam
Raimi.
Now we're
going to get all these complaints, fucking guys.
Let's talk about Sam Raimi.
Like, what do you want us to talk about?
We're going to talk about Sam Raimi.
Okay, we're going to talk about Sam Raimi.
Let's do it.
Sam Raimi was born in 1959 in Michigan.
Wow. You went to Wikipedia for that, didn't you?
Sam Raimi.
So, what was your first exposure to him?
I don't know.
Evil Dead 2. That's mine.
I would probably say Evil Dead 2.
Because yeah. I've said the story in the past. My grandmother visiting from England bought me the VHS.
Yes, you did tell that story.
And then I fell in love with Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
Because Evil Dead 2 was unlike anything I'd ever seen before.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I became aware of his filmmaking style.
Yes.
So his filmmaking style to me is very kinetic.
Yeah.
It's got lots of POV, and he's done this in all of his movies. Lots of POV shots, lots of shots taken from the camera following an item.
Yep.
So like, you know, like someone will shoot a gun. The camera will be the bullet, follow the bullet.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. He's just a very creative guy. I think he's responsible for the whole gearing up montage you see in movies these days. Because in Evil Dead 2, you know, where Ash is in the shed and he's like putting all the gear on to fight the demons and he's like groovy and it's all the quick cuts.
Well, I thought the A-Team was responsible for that.
It might be, but I was associated with Sam. And, you know, I just think he is a fun director. Like, I feel like he's a guy who doesn't really take his job overly serious.
Yeah.
And I find that, you know, I always have fun with his movies because he always has these stable of people who he grew up with in Michigan that he always tries to wedge into his movies. He's obsessed with the Three Stooges, and, you know, there's always a character in his movies called the fake Shemp.
Yeah.
So it's always fun to see who's the fake Shemp in the movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he's actually...
What does the fake Shemp mean?
I'm not quite 100% sure what the fake Shemp, but it is a Three Stooges reference.
And is the Shemp actually in
Shemp,
the movie?
Shemp, I think, was like the fourth Stooge or some.
But is he actually in the movie when you see that credit?
Yeah, it's credited as fake Shemp. Bruce Campbell's being credited as fake Shemp.
No, but is Bruce Campbell actually in the film when you see that credit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember what movie it was I saw, but he was in the movie and he was credited as fake Shemp. He's also responsible for launching the career of Bruce Campbell, speaking of him.
Yeah.
And we will speak about Bruce Campbell in the future.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting that he's one of those guys who he's gone on to be successful as a director. You know, Spider-Man, his Spider-Man movies were the biggest superhero movies, and I think were responsible for starting this trend of superhero movies. And he's made Oz and things like that, but he's still kept it like on a level where he's been associated with these people from when he was in university in Michigan and always tried to give them, you know, cameos or opportunities.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
his
true.
Brothers, Ivan and Ted, both work in the industry. You know, Ivan's actually a doctor by trade, but he's co-written movies with Sam. He co-wrote, you know, Army of Darkness and Darkman and Drag Me to Hell and stuff like that. Ted's very familiar to guys like me who watch too many frickin' B-movies.
Yeah.
He's always showing up in something. The movie I most remember him is this movie called Skinner. Have you ever seen this?
Is that a...
It's like a 1993 slasher kind
of
movie.
Tracy Lords in that?
Tracy Lords. Ted Raimi. And Ted Raimi's like the killer in it.
Yeah.
It's actually a pretty fun movie.
Yeah, I see that.
But yeah, like I just... When we were thinking of guys to talk about, I just thought Sam Raimi would be fun because I have so many good memories associated with his movies.
He also had a big relationship with Scott Spiegel.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think when I think of movies that are fun, I mostly think of him, like, for, like, horror movies and, like, other types. But I think a lot of people discount he has a little bit of a serious side that kind of sways away from his, like, kinetic energy. And we'll talk about that a little bit as we go through his movies. So I was thinking the way I structured my notes is doing his filmography because he hasn't directed a ton of movies.
Okay.
So why don't we just start that way?
Okay.
So we'll start with the obvious, his debut, and the movie that, you know, is my favorite.
His big debut, yeah.
My favorite movie.
Yes.
Of his, of the series, The Evil Dead.
Yes.
From 1982. And so this started...
81.
81, sorry. 81, 82. It's kind of a sketchy window, depending.
1981, 82.
Yeah, around there. 81, 82, it depends. So anyway... It started life as this like 1978 short, 30-minute short film called Within the Woods, which I haven't had an opportunity to see. But it, you know, it was made when they were in university, and then they decided to expand it to this full-length movie. And it's just basically about some people going out into a cabin in the woods and being possessed by demons, really. Like, they find a recording about the Necronomicon, Book of the Dead, and get possessed.
Yeah.
So it's a basic plot. It was made for like $90,000.
Yeah.
And they threw every penny on the screen, I think.
Oh, totally.
Like, and, you know, it's my favorite of the series. I think I'm in a minority on that.
It's my favorite of the series.
Like, I feel like most people like either Evil Dead 2 or Army of Darkness better.
No, I know. Most people do.
Like, for a pure actual horror movie, I think Evil Dead works the best.
It's the one I keep going back to.
Because it has less comedy.
Yeah.
Like, it has comedy, and you can see, like, Sam's kind of sway towards this comedy that would come up in the sequels.
Not a lot of comedy, though.
Not tons, and I feel like I really enjoy the practical gore effects in this. I think they're really cool. Like, you know, the scene with the pencil going in the ankle and, like, the whole...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The whole, like... scene with the floating demon, like like these are where your shots become obvious because it has the floating demon and he's falling face forward.
Yeah.
And the camera is actually following his trajectory.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, the stuff of the demon going through the woods and all that, and the, you know, the tree scene.
Yeah.
I just think these scenes are, like, so iconic now.
Well, and the look of the demons, too, and just the way, this is what Harley Quinn should have been like. Yeah, and like, demons, and she would have really been crazy.
And, like, this is a movie, like, made for nothing that really wouldn't have done nothing if it wasn't for, like, Stephen King saying, this movie is scary as shit.
Yeah.
And that's what made it into this cult movie, and you know, I would really love to have been around when this came out.
Yeah.
And had an opportunity to see this in the theaters.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Because, you know, this is like, I think Evil Dead is actually in my top 10 favorite 80s horror movies.
Nice. Yeah, I'd say probably as well.
Like, for sure. And I feel like maybe we should, like, do you think we should hit the whole series in one go?
Yeah.
So.
It just, the first one just felt so indie as well, right? Like, yeah. It really felt like. Like, it was a pretty much, it was a group of friends going to the woods to make a movie. And
yeah,
that's,
it's like
it
university
really
friends.
Feels like that, yeah.
You know, and like, this is, like, Bruce Campbell, super young, super fresh-faced.
Yeah.
And not quite the, like, comedian he'd become.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was just, like, a standard, like, everyday hero and, you know, playing Ash. And he went through a lot. Like, that's the thing about these movies is that Sam Raimi really liked putting Bruce Campbell through the ringer in these movies.
Yeah.
Like, he really dug it. And you hear stories that he'd do it on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, just to fuck with Bruce, he'd do it on purpose, right?
Yeah.
And that's friendship. You fuck with each other when you're friends.
Yeah.
You know? I do it to you sometimes, you know, like Radiohead.
Yeah.
Stuff like
yeah.
that. But
I don't like Radiohead.
I really think that Evil Dead stands the test of time. And I think that it's got that indie charm to it that's missing from a lot of supposedly indie horror movies
yeah.
of modern day. And,
no,
you know,
I totally agree.
And I feel like the thing about Evil Dead 2, let's skip to Evil Dead 2, is that I really feel like Evil Dead 2 was kind of like Sam Raimi and his friends being like, now we've got more money. Let's do this movie the same but different.
Yeah.
Let's do the same basic story, but we'll, like, make it the way we intended to kind of make it the first time through.
Yeah.
Because really, it is kind of a remake.
Yeah. It's been so long. I haven't seen Evil Dead 2 or Army of Darkness in well over 10 years.
I actually saw snippets of Evil Dead 2 on TV last week.
Okay, good.
So, I mean, I can, because I was flipping through the channels, I'm like, ooh, Evil Dead 2's on. So I stopped and watched a little bit. The thing about Evil Dead 2 is it was my first Sam Raimi movie, so it's always going to have a special place in my heart.
Yeah.
I did not see Evil Dead, the first one, until after, and that's when I fell in love with that movie, but I still love Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
Like, Evil Dead 2 is when, this is him operating at his peak as a director, I feel.
Yeah.
Because this is him being so creative with his camera. You know, just those shots of, like, the zooming through the woods, which is basically a camera, like, a steady cam screwed onto a piece of plywood.
Yeah.
You know, scenes of, like, Ash's character being caught by the demon and flying through the woods, point of view shot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, comedy, so much comedy, but...
Is it, if my memory serves me, is it mainly Bruce Campbell in this movie, just... Like,
a lot of it is just him in the cabin going, like, dealing with demons and his sanity, because,
like, there's not, like, the other characters, like, in the original.
They show up in the second half.
Okay.
So the basics of Evil Dead is two, is him and his girlfriend going to a cabin in the woods that her dad, I think it was her dad, or it wasn't her dad. It was, like, one of the girls who shows up. It was her dad, and find a recording of the incantations from the Necronomicon, which brings the demons back. So, you know, bad things happen with the girlfriend. Ash has to deal with it. He has to deal with demons. There's craziness that goes on. Like, some of my favorite scenes are when Bruce Campbell's character's by himself.
Yeah.
You know, there's the scene with the laughing, you know, where he's losing his marbles and everything
in the
house starts laughing. Like, you see the deer head twist towards him.
Yeah.
He's like, ha, 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 ha.
Yeah.
And he starts laughing with it. And then there's, like, one of those, you know, those desk lamps with the bendy arm? And it's, you know, it's laughing. And then while it's laughing, it's bending down. And Ash looks at it and he starts copying it. And then the lamp, look, they stop and look at each other, and then they start killing themselves laughing. You know, stuff like that, like stuff with his hand being possessed.
Yeah, I remember all
that
stuff.
And like smashing plates over his head and stuff. Yeah. Everything. It's just so much fun.
Yeah.
Like Evil Dead is my go-to for a horror movie. Evil Dead 2 is my go-to for a horror comedy.
Right.
And, you know, and they're similar, but they're enough different that you can see that, you can see in Evil Dead 2 his love of Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Whereas in Evil Dead 1, I don't know if they just maybe made it because they're like, let's make a horror movie because that'll get us, it'll sell.
Right.
Like, I'm not sure what the impetus was behind that, but I do love Evil Dead 2.
Nice. Yeah, I've got all three sitting there. I got
like, I'm not going to discount it. I do love Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
I find it, that's the movie that really broke him through. And it did lead to Army of Darkness, which is a movie that I like.
Yeah.
But I've never understood why people like it so damn much.
Because it's fun.
Yeah, but like,
it's funny. Like, that's the one, to me, like that's the, all the one-liners that Ash had were in Evil, were in Army
well, they
of Darkness.
Were. Yeah. They were. I feel like Army of Darkness was people's gateway to the Evil Dead series, a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like because we're a little older, it would have been Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
But I feel like Army of Darkness was a gateway for people. I do enjoy Army of Darkness, but it's so far away from being a horror movie.
Yeah.
Like, Army of Darkness is basically the Bruce Campbell show.
Yes.
You know, it's him cracking one-liners and getting into situations like, you know, this is where the Three Stooges comes to the forefront.
Yeah.
It's him poking himself in the eye and, like, you know, falling down and all this stuff. You know, it's got those quotes like, good, bad, I'm the guy with the gun. And, you know, you found me attractive once, honey, you got real ugly. You know.
Yeah, this is my boomstick.
Yeah, like all the quotable shit is in Army of Darkness. Yeah. I found it interesting that it was produced by Dino De Laurentiis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Who, he made a lot of blockbuster movies in the 70s and 80s.
King Kong, yo.
King Kong, among other things. And Universal Pictures put out Army of Darkness, which I thought was also kind of strange.
Yeah.
And I don't remember if it did very well. I think it went on to be a cult movie after the fact. But I remember my one friend went to see it in theaters twice.
Right.
And I never got to go see it, so I was mad at him for the longest time. But I just think Army of Darkness is just them goofing around and being like, they gave us money to do this shit. And, you know, whatever. It's a fun movie.
Yeah.
But it's also the movie that's been the most, apart with the Evil Dead series, is the movie that's been the most quadruple dipped of all physical media releases.
Oh my god.
There's been so many DVD, Blu-ray, VHS
different versions
of these movies that it's fucking ridiculous.
Different cuts.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And speaking of different cuts, I think Army of Darkness, I know that Sam prefers the original ending, which is like the Rip Van Winkle type ending.
Right.
I always liked the S-Mart ending myself.
Right.
So maybe it's because it's the one I saw first, but I always preferred that ending, and I they did change some of the one-liners in the director's cut, too, and I'm just going to stick with the whole 82-minute theatrical of that one, I think.
Yeah.
So
I'm looking forward to revisiting all three of these, actually.
Yeah, and then there was a remake in 2013, which he produced, which I thought was pretty good.
It was okay.
I had to shut off my brain that it was an Evil Dead movie, and then I was
We saw that together.
We did.
Yeah.
Once I shut my brain off, I was good with it.
Yeah.
And then Ash vs. Evil Dead, we've discussed this in the past, the TV series.
Did you finish it?
I did.
Okay.
I feel like it was a very roller coaster season in the sense that it started off strong, kind of crapped the bed in the middle, and then picked up at the end. So it was like going up and down hills.
Right.
And I'm interested to see what they do with season two, but I really would have been happy with just the trilogy.
Right.
So,
yeah, that's kind of how I feel about the whole thing.
So, I mean, on the strength of the Evil Dead movies alone, the trilogy, this guy should be a guy we remember.
Yeah.
But there's other movies that I think are just as good.
That's true.
Now we'll jump back in his filmography. So after Evil Dead series, Evil Dead 1, he made a movie called Crime Wave in between Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2.
I feel like this one was a big Three Stooges influence as well.
It was, and this is basically just about these guys who are like vigilantes going around and like... I haven't seen it in so long. I can't remember a lot of it. I
thought about picking up the Anchor Bait because I've only seen like a VHS.
It's out on Blu-ray from Shout Factory.
Yeah. I had a VHS boot of this. That's all I've seen. So yeah. I haven't seen like...
I remember not really liking it properly.
I didn't like it either. It has Bluto from the ill-fated Robert Altman Popeye movie in it. Yeah. Paul L. Smith.
And Brian James.
Brian James from Blade Runner.
Louise Lasser.
Yeah.
And Bruce shows up too.
Right.
And the only thing that I think is worth mentioning about Crime Wave is that it's co-written by Joel and Ethan Coen.
Right, yeah. Yeah, there was a Coen Brothers connection.
You know, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, so on and so forth. Because they're friends with Sam. And I think that's a significant thing, but I really can't comment on it that much because it's just not a movie that I ever think about when I think of Sam.
No, me neither.
Like, it was just one of those blips on the radar. And I think even he's kind of like not really that keen on it.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth. So that's all we're going to say about Crime Wave.
Fair enough.
After Evil Dead 2 came the movie I watched last week.
Yep.
Darkman from 1990.
Yep.
I think this was like training ground for him for making a superhero movie.
Well, what I heard about Darkman is that he originally wanted to make The Shadow.
Yeah.
And he couldn't get the rights, so...
He kind of made a character similar.
Exactly. So it sounds like he just sort of came up with his own shadow.
Yeah, so it's Liam Neeson stars as Peyton Westlake, who's like a scientist type. And he's been working on this kind of formula that is like fake skin.
Yeah.
But the problem is it melts after 90 minutes in the sun. His girlfriend's played by Frances McDormand, who most people know from Fargo.
Right.
And also the wife of one of the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're a couple and they get involved with this bad guy called Robert Durant, played by Larry Drake.
Yes.
And when he's not going, they get this document that he really wants, something about a real estate scheme and like building high rises and stuff. And because they are searching for this document, Peyton just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and gets burnt to a crisp.
Yeah.
Ends up
it's like acid or something.
No, he just gets blown up.
He gets blown up. Okay.
And then he kind of like sets up a makeshift lab in the middle of this abandoned factory, uses his fake skin creations to go for revenge.
Right.
So he kind of disguises himself as the henchman and as Durant and everything and uses that to kind of go on a vigilante spree.
Right.
And I kind of like Darkman.
Yeah, I remember like, not hating it.
Like, it's, I remember the big hype lead up to Darkman. There was always those posters that said, "Who is Darkman?"
Yeah.
You know, and there was like a video game based on this.
Really?
And there was like, yeah, like for Nintendo. And there was a brief comic book series based on this and everything. And
There were sequels as well.
Yeah, two direct-to-video sequels.
With, like, Arnold Vosloo or something.
Yeah, and Larry Drake was back for the second one.
Yeah, The Return of Durant. And Jeff
Fahey played the bad guy in the third one.
Okay.
But I really like Larry Drake in Darkman.
Yeah, he was good.
He just goes around, like, with a cigar trimmer, cutting people's fingers off and just being, like, badass. Like, a lot of people, when they think of Larry Drake, they think of that show L.A. Law.
Yeah, or Dark Knight of the Scarecrow.
He played like a mentally handicapped kind of lawyer-y, like he worked at the lawyer's office. I'm not sure what his job was. I didn't really watch L.A. Law, but he always was like nominated for Emmys for this show and everything. Yeah. For me, Larry Drake's always going to be fucking Robert Durant and Dr. Giggles.
Oh, Dr. Giggles.
So that's all there is to it. But he's really good in this. Liam Neeson, I had no idea who this dude was when this movie came out. He does pretty good job. Frances McDormand is kind of underrated to me. Because she's always solid in everything she's been in.
Yeah.
And it's a very superhero-y vigilante movie. Like, there's a lot of stuff in this that you can tell Sam was, like, working on. Like, there's scenes in it where Peyton will get mad and they'll just be, like, all the background will crumble.
Okay, cool.
And, like, his eyes will go red and there'll be, like, these tight zooms on his eyes. It's got the total Sam Raimi style of filming.
Oh, it does. Okay.
Yeah, but it's got, like, a lot of action scenes in it, like, lots of machine gun fire. It's got that big scene with, like, Darkman swinging from the helicopter and,
you know, it's got some really kind of poor looking optical effects now.
Right.
Like they haven't dated that well.
Right.
But it's just a solid movie. And I can see why he... I think if when they were looking for people to make Spider-Man, I think Darkman was probably pointed at as like, hey, this dude can probably do it.
Right.
You know, and I think Darkman is a fun movie. I don't think it's like one of my favorites of his. But revisiting it recently, I thought it was, you know, entertaining for sure.
Cool.
And
makes me want to watch it again.
It was his first big studio movie too.
Yeah.
So I mean it's interesting to see that he can go from a movie like Evil Dead 2 to a movie like Darkman.
Yeah.
And after that he took a little bit of a break. He has this company called Renaissance Pictures.
Yeah.
With its producing partner Robert Tappert.
Yeah.
And I think he went into like syndicated television production because he started doing like Xena.
Was that around this time?
Yeah, I think it was like...
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah, early 90s, like Xena Warrior Princess with Lucy Lawless and...
Hercules.
Hercules Legendary Journey with like Kevin Sorbo and Mantis. Do you remember that show Mantis?
Yeah, I know he did Mantis.
He created that show. And, you know, there...
Jack of all trades.
Yeah, it's just... He did all those kind of stuff and then...
Bruce.
I guess he decided in 90... I think it was 95?
Yeah.
He wanted to make a Western... So he made The Quick and the Dead.
Yes, he did.
And I really like The Quick and the Dead.
Yeah, I know.
I think it's a really underrated movie.
It's probably my favorite Sam Raimi movie.
Like, it's totally underrated. Yeah. No one talks about The Quick and the Dead.
I love it. Because we've talked in the past, I really like tournament movies.
Yeah, and that's totally what this
is. It's a tournament movie, and it's really...
The basic of this movie is that Sharon Stone plays a female gunslinger who comes to this town run by Gene Hackman at probably his sleaziest best. Like
Hackman
I thought he was
is always so
I
good.
Thought he was great in this movie. And it's like about a tournament, like a quick draw tournament.
Yeah.
And it's also like the cast in this movie, man. If you look back at this movie,
I know.
It's like Sharon Stone, Gene Hackman, Leonardo DiCaprio, and Russell Crowe.
And Keith David,
baby. Like, come on. This is like...
And Gary Sinise is in there, too. Yeah,
and Gary Sinise. This is like him... it's like him doing kind of a spaghetti Western in a way.
Yep.
But with his, like, typical style of, like, having, you know, bullets. Watching bullets from the angle of the bullet going into people. And, you know, just that kinetic energy that he brings to everything. You know, people getting... I just really like this movie.
I love this movie.
Like, I think it's a totally underrated movie.
And this is another one where I'm just like, you know, I'm watching Sam's movies coming out again, mainly from Scream Factory.
Yeah.
And
Nobody talks about this one.
I'm just like, why isn't someone picking up The Quick and the Dead? It's like got this, like, I think it's got a Blu-ray release, but it's like bare bones. And it's just, you know, like it's just stellar cast, great flick, super entertaining, fast moving. I just really wish someone would snap this one up and give it some love because it's a great one.
I just think that, like, remember there was, like, in the early 90s to mid-90s, there was that trend of, like, trying to do, like, kind of more hip modern Westerns?
Well, I remember it was a time of Tombstone.
Yeah,
and
Tombstone and Bad Girls.
Wild Bill. Yeah.
American Outlaws and all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This one stands head, maybe comparable with Tombstone. I really do like Tombstone.
Yeah.
But I think this is heads and tails above like Bad Girls and things
that.
Like,
for sure.
Bad Girls was like one of those, like, it was directed by Jonathan Kaplan, who's made some good movies in his past. It's got Drew Barrymore, Andy McDowell, Madeline Stowe.
Right.
Good cast. But weak movie.
It was a weak movie.
But this.
Totally not memorable.
But then you have Sharon Stone in this movie proving that you can make a Western where the main character is female.
And people were horrified when she was cast in this.
And just
kicked
so much ass.
Yeah.
People point at Sharon Stone and say Basic Instinct. I point at Sharon Stone and say Quick and the Dead.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, she's way better in this movie than she was in
Basic
Instinct.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so Quick and the Dead, if you can find it, definitely.
Yeah, it's out there. It's just like Chris said, no one talks about it. And the Blu-ray release is just kind of meh. But
I think it's funny, though, because when I was looking into his filmography, I feel like in between... The period for him in between Darkman and Spider-Man, there's so many solid movies in there that are just like forgotten.
See, I disagree.
You disagree with me?
I think this was like a bad period for him.
I actually disagree. Then we're going to disagree here because the movie he made after Quick and the Dead was A Simple Plan.
Yeah, and you know,
I love A Simple Plan.
Yeah.
Like
I don't even remember it.
I love it.
Just in and out of my brain.
Premise of this movie is Bill Paxton and Billy Bob Thornton play brothers.
Yep.
Billy Bob Thornton's character is a little bit slow-witted. His girlfriend is played by Bridget Fonda. Bill Paxton's girlfriend is played by Bridget Fonda. They're kind of like backwoodsy. And they find a plane, a small plane, crashed in the forest, filled with a dead body and tons of money.
Yep.
So they take this money because, you know, opportunists, right? So the basics of this movie is like, it's like a crime caper because it's about them having this money, someone trying to hunt down this money, and just the way the money corrupts them over time.
Yeah.
And makes them like be at each other's throat and change their personalities and everything. And I just think it's a really good movie because it's, the cast is stellar. And the ending of this movie is one of my favorite endings of a crime movie ever. I'm not going to spoil it, but it's one of my favorite endings because it's got one of those ironic twists to it, which I really loved.
You just spoiled it.
I didn't spoil it. I just said it's got
saying
a twist
it's got
it.
An ironic twist is kind of a spoiler.
It doesn't spoil anything. And it's also the movie that proves...
You're like the master of spoilers.
No, I'm not. This proves to me that along with Sling Blade and this, Billy Bob Thornton can act. It's just unfortunate that he's chosen now to do movies like Mr. Woodcock and
or
Bad
Faster.
Santa 2.
Faster.
And Faster. Like, this guy can act.
Yeah.
And I just don't know why he's not doing it. And I feel like this movie is also the most standard of Sam's movies for directorial style. Like, this is just more of a cut and paste, like, straightforward filmed kind of movie. No real big tricks to it and everything.
No.
But I really do like this movie.
Not capitalizing on his strengths at all.
I really do like it, though.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good movie. I really think this period for Bridget Fonda was really good, too.
Yeah.
And then she's kind of fallen off the radar.
Yeah, she's quit the acting world.
You know, like, Single White Female, Simple Plan. I liked her in Point of No Return, even though it's basically a La Femme Nikita riff.
Yeah.
So, she was good.
Jackie Brown.
Yeah, she was good back then.
Yeah.
So, it's unfortunate. But Josh will disagree with me on A Simple Plan, I guess.
But it just was...
Yeah. I recommend it as a...
Yeah.
As a crime movie. If you like crime movies, then you'll probably dig it.
I just felt like it was... It didn't really have an impact on me. I get what you're saying about the acting and all that, but I was expecting a Sam Raimi movie, and yeah. I just felt like anyone could have directed this.
I felt
like a Coen Brothers movie.
I haven't seen it in a while, but I do. Last time I watched it, I've seen it about 3 times, and I've liked it every time.
Great.
So.
That's awesome.
Yeah, about 3 times. The follow-up to that was The Gift.
Yeah.
And unfortunately...
So you're saying this was this interesting period.
I thought it was interesting because it was different.
Yeah, boring.
Well, okay. The Gift is the movie that's mostly known for Katie Holmes' boobs.
For 2 seconds.
Anytime anyone talks about The Gift, they're just like, oh, is that that movie where Katie Holmes shows her boobs?
Well, it was a gift.
Maybe for you, Josh.
They were nice. I was surprised.
I just thought this was a solid gothic thriller.
Yeah.
Because Cate Blanchett stars as this psychic who she's tasked by the townsfolk to... Like, Katie Holmes' character goes missing and then shows up later. You know, this isn't... I'm not spoiling. It's an easy plot point. It's early in the movie.
Okay.
So, she's trying to figure out what happened to Katie Holmes' character, basically, by having psychic visions. This is more in line with Sam's style in the sense that the visions are kind of like that nightmarish kinetic energy that he has in his past movies. I thought the mood in this movie was really dark. I thought it's got a good cast, too. You know, you got Hilary Swank, Keanu Reeves, J.K. Simmons. You know, solid cast, gothic
Giovanni
thriller.
Ribisi.
Yep. Gothic thriller, solid movie. I enjoyed it. You thought it was boring.
I did.
Moving on.
I was glad when this era ended.
There's one more movie before Spider-Man, though.
I haven't seen it.
Which is the most weird movie in
this
film.
I can't comment on it.
I haven't seen it either.
So
but
it might be really good.
I find it really strange.
But it feels, again, like not a Sam Raimi movie.
It's a movie called For the Love of the Game.
Yeah.
Starring Kevin Costner. And it's a baseball movie.
But why is it strange?
Because it's Sam Raimi.
He likes baseball.
But I don't get it.
The previous two movies he made were also, like, you don't think those were strange. They were kind of boring. Anyone could have directed them.
But the thing is, this is a baseball drama. Up to this point, he hasn't made really anything that's like a standard mainstream drama like
this
was.
Well, that Simple Plan seemed like that to me, as did The Gift. They both seemed like kind of like boring, straightforward, anyone could have directed the movies.
Maybe to you.
But you just sort of said that yourself.
I never said that anyone could direct them.
Well, they were missing the whole...
I thought A Simple Plan was a pretty straightforward movie, but I thought The Gift did have a lot of touches that he is known for.
Yeah.
I said that.
Okay.
And now you're arguing with me.
No, he said in the dream sequences it had that.
Yeah. So
I just the whole movie dream sequences? Now I'm arguing.
There was a lot.
Okay.
I just find For the Love of the Game a little bit odd of choice for him to make.
Well, I haven't seen it. Maybe the camera's going with the baseball. Who knows?
Maybe, but it's like you have a guy who made a movie about demonic demons, like possessed deep people, a movie about a bandaged-faced superhero, a movie about some jealous rednecks and money, a movie about a psychic, and then he makes a movie about baseball with Kevin Costner.
From my understanding of Sam Raimi at this point in his career is that he was a big fan of baseball. So okay. If I'm looking at from what I know of him,
fair enough.
This seems like the movie that seemed the most personal to him of these three.
Fair enough.
In
I have
my world, the dark era.
the dark era.
But this one seems
not
like the
dark
one,
man era.
The one that he maybe wanted to do the most. You know?
Could be.
I don't get the other two. Particularly, I don't get The Gift. I don't understand why where that came from. Because I was expecting a Sam Raimi movie, especially after The Quick of the Dead.
Right.
And he had established a very distinctive style at that point.
Right.
So I just didn't understand what he was doing at this point in his career. And thank God he got out of this. Because I feel like he was sinking.
Well, I haven't seen For the Love of the Game, but I did enjoy both those movies.
Yeah.
But then comes The Salad Days of Sam Raimi.
Thank God.
We're talking Spider-Man.
Yes.
1, 2, and 3.
Yes.
So let's talk about them. First one, 2002. Second one, 2004. Third one, 2007.
Yep.
First one's a basic origin story.
Yep.
Tobey Maguire playing Peter Parker, who's bitten by a radioactive spider and becomes Spider-Man.
Yep.
Kirsten Dunst is...
the only superhero movies Chris has seen.
I've seen more than this dude. I've seen the first Captain America movie, and I've seen the first three X-Men movies.
Oh, okay.
And I've seen Iron Man 1.
Oh,
so, you know, I've seen some.
All right.
I just have got so bored with how many are coming out. That's why I don't watch them. I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen Kick-Ass. That counts. But anyway.
don't get me started on Kick-Ass now.
I feel like the 2002 Spider-Man is one of the movies totally responsible for what we're seeing now, though.
Yes, I agree.
Because it was a huge hit when it came out.
Yeah.
It was a superhero movie done right.
Yeah.
Because up to this point, they were just silly, kind of not taken too seriously. And I feel like there's some stuff in this that's like comedic, but it's also taken a lot more seriously. Like they actually took time to establish Peter Parker. And it's definitely got the style of Sam.
Yeah, for sure.
That we've seen in the past. You know, it's got that fast cutting kinetic energy. He manages to squeeze in a cameo from Bruce Campbell, of course. And, you know, I like Spider-Man, but...
When did Bob Murawski start editing for Sam? Was that around this time?
I think he did before that.
Okay.
I think he did prior. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
But I know he's, like, a longtime editor with him. If I knew how to spell his last name, I'd look it up, but it's okay. I feel like jumping from Spider-Man, which was a huge hit,
And then we hit Spider-Man 2, which, as we've said in the past, best superhero movie ever made.
Why did we talk about that in the past?
Because we were talking about sequels or something.
Oh, yeah, sequels.
Spider-Man 2 is the best superhero movie ever made. People can argue with me, but I will never change my opinion. The reason for that is they got the origin story out of the way. They got a wicked villain in Dr. Octopus, Alfred Molina.
Yeah.
And they made... I feel like this is the movie that Sam Raimi himself was like, this is the movie I want to make for Spider-Man.
Right.
Because I feel like they're like, okay, I have to make an origin movie, obviously, because it's the first one.
Yeah.
This was like, okay, I've got the origin out of the way. Now I can really do what I want to do with
exactly.
the character.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great. It's like nonstop entertainment.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the new Spider-Mans with Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker. But for me, I just feel like Tobey Maguire is just perfect.
Yeah, Tobey Maguire was the best Spider-Man. I don't like the new guy because Andrew Garfield's now passé.
Is there a new guy after him now?
There's a new guy. He was in the Civil War, Captain America.
Oh, Jesus. How many times are they going to change it?
I don't know. But Andrew Garfield's no longer Spider-Man. Just
okay. Well, I didn't know. See? Shows you how much I pay attention to superhero movies. But I just think Spider-Man 2, again, the same thing, is that you give him a budget that high and let him go crazy with the camera and he's going to deliver exactly what you expect from him.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is a big Hollywood movie with a director who has still indie aesthetics and is willing to take chances on how he frames shots.
Yeah.
And does the action sequences, you know. I don't remember seeing anything quite as impressive as this for action sequences when I saw Spider-Man 2 in 2004. And I think that he was a perfect choice to make the first two.
Yeah.
Not so much part 3.
Yeah, I don't know what happened with part 3.
I think part 3 was just too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Because I think that the failing of part 3 was having two villains, for starters.
Yeah.
Having Sandman and
Venom.
And Venom. And then fucking up Venom so badly. Because I know you're not a comic book guy, but they screwed up Venom badly in Spider-Man 3. Because I hated in the third one how Topher Grace plays Venom from that 70s show. And they kept, anytime he wanted to talk, they kept morphing to show his face.
Oh, okay.
I would rather it was just the Venom costume and he talked through the Venom costume like he does in the comic.
Right.
Whereas they kept morphing it back to his face. I don't want to see Topher Grace all the fucking time. Venom's badass in the comics.
Yeah.
I don't need to see that.
Right.
And just like making Tobey Maguire having that hipster moment where he's like dancing and strutting down the street after he puts on the black clothes. I'm like, no, this isn't doing it for me.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know what went wrong with that movie. I think it was just got to the point where Sam was getting exhausted.
Yeah. It just didn't feel like the same caliber as the first.
Yeah, like he made these movies really quick succession. And, you know, at the time, I think he was signed up to do three more.
Right.
And then he dropped out of part 4 because he was like saying, this is just too much for me.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting period because I feel like people hate 3.
They do.
I don't hate it, but I can understand why.
Right.
Like, I feel like out of all the movies we've talked about that he's directed, after Crime Wave, this is probably his poorest effort, is Spider-Man 3. I don't know if you'll agree with me.
I'm not going to agree with you.
You seem to hate The Gift and Simple Plan.
Well, yeah, this is a tough call for me.
Yeah, so...
But I'd have to do some revisiting to make that decision, yeah.
Did you see the Spider-Man movies in theaters?
Yes.
Because I saw all 3 of them in theaters.
I did too.
And I saw the 3rd one on IMAX.
Wow.
And
I just remember it being a disappointment. I remember being excited.
Yeah, like I remember not hating it, but coming out of it being like...
Mm. But even there, I was like, Topher Grace? Really?
Yeah.
Like, it just didn't feel... And yeah, the two villain things seemed weird. Thomas Hayden Church had just come off. This was around Sideways time, but like he wasn't like a big star. But I kind of saw him, but I didn't know the villain that he was playing. Like you know, before this, I knew who Doc Ock was and I knew who Green Goblin was. Yeah. I didn't know who this guy was. So,
yeah, I knew Sandman from the comics.
Yeah,
too. But I just feel like having two villains was just too much.
Yeah.
And I felt like the story was more disjointed this time. I feel like the stylistic touches he brought to the first two wasn't there quite. Just seemed like he was tired.
Yeah.
That's what it felt like to me, that he was just super tired. So.
So he said, fuck you, Spider-Man. I'm going to go back to the horror genre.
He's got to go back to his roots. And I'm so fucking glad he went back to his roots,
yes,
dude.
So am I.
Like, man, I remember in 2009, before Drag Me to Hell came out, and I heard he was making a horror movie again.
Yeah.
I was so fucking stoked.
Yeah.
And then it came out. I rushed to the theater. Movie didn't do that hot, I don't think, for...
No, it didn't.
But I loved it.
Yeah, I think I saw it twice in a week.
Like, I fucking loved that movie, dude.
Yeah, and it's pretty rare that that happens, where someone this deep into their career can go and pull something like this and...
Well, like, after you've been so far removed from the genre that established you...
Yeah.
And come back to it and nail it...
Yeah.
It's just... It's astonishing.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like this was him freeing himself too, where he's like, oh, I've been locked down in these Spider-Man movies for the last like 10 years. Now I'm going to get to do something that I want to do that's fun.
Yeah.
No, I'm not saying he didn't want to do the Spider-Man movies, but I feel like by the end he was like, I'm fucking done.
Well, that's the thing. These franchises are just destroying careers left, right, and center. You know, they're tying up these actors and these directors
And nowadays, the contracts are written with sequel clauses.
Well, look at Peter Jackson.
I know.
It's over.
I know. He was like, he didn't even want to do The Hobbits after the first one.
Yeah. And Raimi, the same thing. Like, thank God he pulled himself out of this, because, you know, it just would have been Raimi doing Spider-Man movies forever. And it's just too bad.
So I couldn't have imagined that Drag Me to Hell would be so good.
Yeah.
It's Alison Lohman kind of picking up the task of being abused.
Yeah.
She kind of takes the Bruce Campbell role in this.
Yeah.
So, you know, Sam couldn't beat the crap out of Bruce in this, so he decides to beat the crap out of his female lead in this movie, because she goes through the ringer.
Yeah, she does.
So she's like a bank employee who like denies a loan to this like old gypsy lady.
Yeah.
And then ends up getting cursed.
Yeah.
And bad shit happens to her.
Yeah.
And the thing about this movie is, it's like, there's so much memorable stuff in this movie. You know, there's like projectile vomiting, and like there's that big brawl scene in like the underground parking, which is so fucking good.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, this movie was PG-13. I don't even know how the hell they got away with this movie being PG-13.
Yeah.
It's like so over the top. It's so Sam Raimi.
Yeah, it is.
Like, there's a scene in it where a goat gets possessed and fucking comes to life and calls her a filthy whore. Like, come on. It's so good.
Yeah, it really is.
I love Drag Me to Hell.
Yeah.
I might watch Drag Me to Hell tomorrow. I love it so much. It's just everything I want from a Sam Raimi movie, and I'm so glad he pulled it off.
Yeah.
I'm super disappointed that not as many people went to see it, but I feel like it's really got a second life.
Yeah, I think people have discovered it now.
Yeah, like, it's like one of those, it's like one of a movie like Slither by James Gunn.
Yeah.
It's a movie I feel like if people actually took the time and watched it, they would really love it.
Yeah.
You know, and like I compare it to Slither because the movies came out about the same time. They both had that tonal kind of silly, you know, tone, but they were serious about their horror scenes too.
Yeah.
And Drag Me to Hell, thankfully, has come out on Blu-ray. Slither has not.
Yeah.
But Drag Me to Hell was a return to form, for sure. And, you know, I think it's probably my favorite of his after The Evil Deads.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
I'd go with Quick and the Dead first, but...
Yeah, I do love Quick and the Dead, but I think Drag Me to Hell... I remember coming out of the theater after seeing Drag Me to Hell just so fucking elated.
Yeah, it was good.
Just thinking to myself, man, that delivered everything I wanted from his new movie. And it being a horror movie similar in style to Evil Dead. So good.
So I wonder if old Sam will do it again.
I'm hoping.
So am I.
We saw slight glimmers of it in the pilot episode of Ash vs. Evil Dead.
Yeah.
Because he directed that. But I hope he does it again. Because the movie he made after Drag Me to Hell, his last movie actually, was Oz, Great and Powerful. I haven't seen it. You said you've seen it, so why don't you talk about it a little bit?
I don't have a lot to say about it. I mean, I was pretty excited that Raimi was doing this because I do like The Wizard of Oz, and this is
the problem is it was a Disney movie, right?
In the same universe. I don't know if it was a Disney movie.
Because I feel like the Frank Baum books it's based on are a pretty tight universe.
Because I think Wizard of Oz is Warner Brothers, so it might be Warner. Anyway, who cares?
Anyway, yeah.
But it was okay. I mean, it was nice to see a new Oz movie, but I wasn't watching it going, oh, Sam's back, you know, like.
Well, and there's a sequel coming out without him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun.
Just seems like it was just this CG effects extravaganza to me.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like good witch, bad witch, and, you know, Mila Kunis, and she's always nice to look at. And
James Franco.
Yeah. I mean, it was, like I said at the very beginning of this podcast, it was another one of these ones where it didn't enamor me the way I kind of hoped it would.
It's kind of like, I don't know what it is, but it's like that one, Oz, and For Love of the Game, I just had no interest in seeing, and I had always gone out of my way to see his movies.
Yeah.
So I don't know why For the Love of the Game, but I can tell you Oz, I can tell you that after Drag Me to Hell, and then I saw him doing this effects heavy kind of family-ish movie, I was just kind of like, no.
Yeah.
Not for me. So we'll see where he goes now. I saw he's attached to something called World War III. I'm not quite sure what it is, but we'll see if it happens.
I think that's based on a book about like the end of the world type thing.
Okay.
So that could be interesting. I can't remember the name of the book, but it's based on a book.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's his filmography.
Yeah.
We've gone over it. I think we've established that the main thing I like personally about him is his ability to kind of shift between comedic moments, horror moments, and, you know, but keeping things interesting.
Yeah.
Because he's definitely one of the guys who uses the camera the most to it is his advantage in most of his films.
Most of his films.
but you see, like...
Sorry, I'm going to stop ripping on these movies.
But that's the thing, like...
I just think Sam's strength is using the camera.
Well, it is. And that's the thing.
When he's not doing that, I just feel like he's not.
You don't really see people using the camera like he does.
No.
And that's why we wanted to talk about him a little bit, because I really do think that he's kind of a distinct vision.
He is.
Amongst
these
directors. And, you know, I've loved a lot of his movies, and I really would like him to make more stuff. But I feel like I'm not sure what I want from him at this stage in his career.
Yeah.
Because I feel like he can't return to the days of Quick and the Dead and Evil Dead and Dark Man.
Well, he did with Drag Me to Hell.
I know, but it didn't work. It was an experiment that didn't work for, like, box office returns.
Right.
It worked for us as fans of his movies.
Yeah.
But it just didn't work. Like, I don't think they're going to give him the money to do that again. Because it wasn't a success, really.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know where he's going to go from here. And you know, it seems like he's focused a lot now on production.
Yeah.
You know, like we talked about Renaissance Pictures, and, you know, they are producing Ash vs. Evil Dead series right now and all the syndicated shows we mentioned. But he also founded Ghost House with Robert Tappert. And, you know, they're responsible for, what was it they were responsible for? The Grudge remake, and, you know.
Didn't they do, like, Ghost Ship and all that?
No, that was Dark Castle.
Right.
They did The Grudge. They did, they're doing that Don't Breathe.
Oh, yeah.
Which is directed by the Fede Alvarez, who did Evil Dead 2013. And I really want to see that one. I think it looks really good.
Cool.
And they had a label on DVD called Ghost House Underground.
Yeah, I remember that.
Who put out some pretty interesting stuff, like The Thaw with Val Kilmer, which is supposed to be really good.
The Mammoth movie, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it's pretty good. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
And they did a movie called Dance of the Dead, which is like about zombies at a prom.
Oh, yeah.
That I think is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I really like that one. But yeah, it's interesting that I feel like Ghost House is kind of him getting his, getting off on his horror stuff that he still really enjoys.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have that outlet anymore, because now he's considered to be a Hollywood big budget director.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's what Ghost House kind of is. And I mean, he's had success. They did like the Boogeyman movies and, you know, they're not the greatest movies in the world, but I think they're turning a pretty decent profit. I'm just curious about where he's going to go as a director.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping for the best.
Yeah. Well, he's still got a few years left in him. So.
But who knows, right? But why don't we've established our ranking here, right? You say Evil Dead, Quick and the Dead, so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, I'd say the Evil Dead series and Quick and the Dead and probably Spider-Man would be my my favorites. But
Spider-Man,
there's really
2.
Not a lot
Spider-Man
here to 2. Choose from, right?
Spider-Man 2, right?
Yeah, if we're going to rank, like, what are we going to do, like, top five or something?
Well, he's only made, like, 10 movies, so.
Top three?
Top three would be Evil Dead.
My top three would all have the word dead in the title.
Evil Dead, Drag Me to Hell, and Quick and the Dead. Or no, Spider-Man 2 probably knocks out Drag Me to Hell.
Okay, mine would probably be Evil Dead.
Spider-Man 2, Quick and the Dead.
No, I'd say Evil Dead, Quick and the Dead, Drag Me to Hell.
No Spider-Man 2?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be my choice.
Okay, so interesting.
Yeah. Maybe Evil Dead 2 instead of... It's tough, right? I mean, he has made some great movies.
Yeah.
But For the Love of the Game, The Gift, and Simple Plan were not in either of our top threes.
So the essential, Sam Raimi movie is Evil Dead. The most underrated Sam Raimi movie, we'll see if we agree on this, is Quick and the Dead.
Yes.
And the Sam Raimi movie you don't need to bother with is Crime Wave.
Yes.
Okay.
And I would say the essential would be Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2. I would probably put them together.
You could probably watch
just
them together.
It's two different styles.
Just as contrast and...
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, you know, they're the same movie essentially, but he just had more money for the second one.
Yeah.
So it just shows you maybe what he was intending to do.
If you want that style, you know, I'd say go with both of those.
Yeah, double...
To really see.
Double feature him, why not?
Yeah, double feature that shit.
Yeah.
Health, triple feature it.
Yeah.
Throw Army of Darkness in.
Yeah. But, you know...
Spend the next... Rainy Sunday watching the Army of...
Spend four and a half hours watching the Evil Dead trilogy. Yeah. You'll thank us.
You wanted to talk about his acting a little bit?
We'll quickly talk about his acting and then we'll wrap up.
Okay.
He has made a lot of appearances in like small roles in movies. There's only two movies I really want to talk about for his acting because we're going to go back to his associations with people he knew in Michigan.
Right.
Scott Spiegel and Josh Becker. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1985, Josh Becker made a movie called Thou Shalt Not Kill Except.
Right.
It was based on a short...
Great cover.
Great cover. It was based on a movie, a short film he made called Striker's War in 1981 that starred Bruce Campbell.
Okay.
So him and Bruce were friends. So by proxy, Sam was a friend of theirs. And if you haven't seen... Thou Shall Not Kill Except, you should check it out. Synapse has a really, really great Blu-ray out there.
Oh, I didn't know that.
The Blu-ray's amazing.
I gotta explore Synapse's catalog.
It's a movie shot on 60mm, but you can't tell when you watch the Blu-ray.
Wow.
So it's basically about some war veterans coming home from I think it's Vietnam, and there's a cult in town who are, you know, causing havoc. And our soldiers aren't going to stand for that, so they go for revenge.
Nice.
Sam Raimi is the main villain in this piece. He plays the cult leader, and he's an obvious Charles Manson inspiration because he's kind of a hippie type, and he wears a bandana, and he's got the long stringy hair.
Right.
He's over the top in this movie.
Right.
For sure. And he's got that immortal line in this movie where he looks at someone who's messing around with like someone they just cut up. And he's like, don't ever touch the sacrificial fluids. Okie dokie. It's just, he's very memorable in this movie for a guy who doesn't really act.
Yeah.
And That Shall Not Kill is actually a really good movie for like a low budget culty type movie. Synapse, like I said, put out an amazing Blu-ray.
Nice.
So that one. Also noteworthy is that Scott Spiegel co-wrote it, which leads me to the next movie Sam was in called Intruder.
Yeah.
From 1988. This is a movie that Scott Spiegel wrote and directed. He also co-wrote Evil Dead 2. Can't forget about that.
Right.
It's basically a slasher movie set in a grocery store. So, you know, it's the staff members of a grocery store spending the night stocking the shelves and a killer's loose in the store.
Yeah.
This movie I first heard about from Fangoria back in the day because they had gore pictures.
The bandsaw.
Yeah, because back then, Fangoria was good for having these gore pictures, and that would get me excited about these horror movies. And then it came out on VHS from Paramount Pictures, Phantom Video Line, and they cut the shit out of it.
Wasn't it called like Night Shift or something?
No,
like
it was called Intruder on VHS, but they cut it to ribbons.
Right.
And it was a real tragedy. Sam Raimi plays a meat department employee.
Yeah.
He's the one who gets the infamous bandsaw.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's not in it a lot, but I just think it's fun that Spiegel, who's one of his best friends, gave him the best, you know, send-off in the movie. I really do like Intruder. I think it's one of my favorite slasher movies from the late 80s, for sure. And again, if you need to see this movie, you need to get the Synapse Blu-ray.
I have the Synapse Blu-ray.
It's an uncut version. It was released uncut originally by Wizard Video on DVD, which is Charles Band's label.
Yeah.
But it was full frame. The Blu-ray is widescreen, anamorphic, great looking, uncut. So it's got all that gore I saw in Fangoria back in the day. If you can find it, when they were originally putting out, you could order it from Synapse and it came with like a work print.
Yeah, that's the one I have.
On DVD.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare, but if you can find it, cool, go for it. But
people have a hard time finding that.
Yeah, probably. But
that was like a burned copy from Spiegel himself, I believe.
Yeah, it's you don't like Spiegel too much.
I hated Dust Till Dawn too. That's what...
Yeah, like you've got a thing. He also directed Hostel 3.
Yeah, I haven't seen Hostel
3. So, you know, but I just think it's funny that even though he's now a Hollywood director, like I said, he's still keeping all these people who are close to them at the beginning of the career with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's commendable.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's Sam Raimi.
Great.
So why don't you head over to our group on Facebook or wherever else you can get in touch with us, Twitter, what have you. You can get to all that stuff from www.thevideograveyard.com/GBWpodcast.
Great.
Let us know what your favorite Sam Raimi movies are. Tell us Josh is wrong about A Simple Plan or The Gift, or maybe I'm wrong about it. We'll figure that out. But let us know what you think of Sam Raimi and complain to us that we talked, you know, an hour and a half about what we watched. Although Josh said you guys like it, so cool. And we're going to do our plea at the end here that we always kind of do about if you like what you're hearing, send us some feedback. Let us know what we're doing right. Let us know what we're doing wrong. Go to iTunes. Give us a rating. Give us a review. Helps us get a little bit more exposure.
Just think, if one person from every episode had done that, we would have 48 ratings.
Yeah.
But we have 5.
We have 8.
We have 8?
We have 8.
Well, not 8 comments.
No, 3 comments.
Oh, 3 comments.
But more of those would be good. Otherwise... Should we leave them with some Radiohead, Josh?
No, let's just go.
All right.
I'm tired. Thanks
for listening, people. A little bit shorter than last time. We're not splitting it into two. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time or so.
2 weeks-ish.
2 weeks-ish?
It's summer, yo.
It's vacations are over now. So
well, for you.
A little bit more regularity.
I got vacation.
Well, I've got one in November.
Oh yeah,
but people don't need to know that shit. They just want us to go.
Okay, it'll be pretty much 2 weeks.
All right.
No one cares.
All right. See you guys next time.
Bye.